Extra Thursday. Thanks so much for tuning in to another edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by our friends at Nosler. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards, your host, coming to you once again from beautiful, bucolic Farmville, Virginia, site of the 2016 vice presidential debate. Coming up on the program this hour, our friend Jim Garrity of National Review is just standing by. We'll talk with Jim in just one second. James Dellenpole of Breitbart London later in the hour, talking about the EU taking some initial steps on gun control. Also, Ash Scow of the Washington Examiner next hour, talking about the cottage industry of campus grievance culture. And speaking of that, specifically at the University of North Dakota, you may have seen the story of the college professor who flipped out over the sight of ROTC cadets on campus. Now, the University of North Dakota student government has passed a resolution calling on the professor to apologize for her comments about the ROTC. Rob Port with Say Anything Blog will join us next hour talking about that. Rob Pincus of the Personal Defense Network on perhaps the gawkerest of gawker articles that I have seen here. Guns won't protect you, old people. You're too old and weak, is the honest-to-God headline at Gawker. This is also, by the way, filed under the olds. So, yeah. Kurt Schlichter of Conservative Insurgency going to close things out as well. And right now, I want to welcome to the program Jim Garrity from National Review. How you doing, sir?
When you talk about Gawker, that's going to be Hulk Hogan soon, right?
I believe so, yes. I believe it's going to be Hoganer, yeah.
This was the gossip website that somehow managed to appall a Manhattan jury, right? Cynical, hard-bitten New Yorkers who think they've seen everything, heard about the editorial standards and the mentality and the entire philosophy and the operating style of Gawker, and said, yeah, just turn it over to the professional wrestler. He can only improve it, and turned it into a better, more ethical, and I think they were just looking for what they only came up with the number of damages they did against Gawker because infinity wasn't an option.
I believe that there's a big banner that just says "Embrace the Suck" there at the headquarters now, because apparently they've decided that, you know, their revenue stream is contingent on getting everybody under the age of 40 who despises old people to click on their stories. I guess, I don't know. It's kind of a weird piece, honestly, but we'll talk about it with Rob Pincus, who has a different opinion, by the way, about senior citizens being able to defend themselves with firearms. We've got some stories as well to share with you as well.
He has a different philosophy than accept the sweet embrace of death.
Yeah, I can share a little bit of it if you'd like to just get a little sense of what we're talking about here. Hamilton Nolan is the author. Again, this is filed under the olds. We live in scary times, he writes. Sharia law, foreigners, and rape gangs haunt the streets of this once great nation. Some old people believe that they must arm themselves in order to find peace and safety. Wrong. Old people, wrong. Want to find safety? Can you even find the safety on the handgun you've purchased? Probably not very quickly with your poor eyesight and fingers ravaged by arthritis.
Somebody drag this to Hamilton Nolan. I'm guessing Hamilton Nolan sound. He writes like a teenager, but I'm going to assume that he's, you know, 20-something.
Sure. Let's assume.
So, like, at some point, I hope someone comes back in 40, 50, 60 years to Mr. Nolan and says, hey, remember this? Remember when you thought getting old was hilarious? And, you know, old people were so pathetic. And, ugh, you know, good thing that'll never happen to you, right? And, of course, here he is. So.
Yeah.
Logan's Run was really big amongst young people.
Right.
Right. The idea of, you know, senior citizens being churned up into milkshakes suddenly didn't seem like such a palatable idea. So
when you're old, you're slow as hell, and decades of muscle erosion have made you weak. Pretty much any healthy young person can beat you up. Is a gun going to even things out? Nope. In order for that gun to work, you have to pull it out and aim it in a moment of crisis. While you're fumbling to do that all slow, a young person's just pushing you on the ground and taking your gun out of your feeble hands. Leave the guns to the young nuts, oldie.
How many senior citizens are going to arm themselves just in case they were running? Just in case. First of all, do you think Harrison Nolan describes like pushing down old people just a little bit of too much glee? Like he's thought this through too much.
Oh, by the way, so
there's no way that even if that old person is armed, there's no way they'd be able to pull it out quickly enough and shoot me.
So, so a little bit more on Hamilton Nolan. 2014, the Daily Banter website. had 10 questions with Gawker's Hamilton Nolan. They called him Gawker's longest tenured and best writer, and has been instrumental in shaping the media behemoth into what it is today. So,
the proud ownership of Hulk Hogan?
Bravo, right? Bravo. I don't know of anywhere else that offers both the freedom of Gawker and the audience of Gawker, he said. Most places can offer you either freedom or a lot of readers, but not both. Many places will say that they want you to come here and do the same thing you do at Gawker, but the reality is very few places are prepared to offer writers this much free rein. Like,
maybe for good reason.
yeah. Let's see if there's anything else. The whole thing that drew me into journalism in the first place was the promise that journalism could be used to get the bad guys and help the good guys.
Okay, wait a second. Mocking old people as being too geriatric and their hands are too shaky and the eyesight is too poor, their muscles doing...
Old people are the bad guys,
the
Jim.
Right?
Old clearly, to Hamilton, old people are the bad guys.
Yes.
You know, and they must be stopped so that the young criminals can have their way. He says, this is the same thing that draws people into police work. Wow.
Yeah. Ah, okay, well, there we go.
Right.
Cam, we get the feeling like he's just going to, I got into journalism so I could mock old people. And if he had said he'd done that, fine. There's an entire genre of National Lampoon and other institutions that have kind of done that, or had this kind of, anti-establishment, anti-older generation thing. There was an old joke that the Rolling Stones were going to change the lyric to a song saying, I hope I die before I get older as they age. This kind of angry adolescent pose doesn't work well into your, at some point. At some point you age out of that cranky, I'm standing up to the man demographic. It's almost like there's a book he could use to read. He could stand to read, huh?
Well, I can only imagine what Hamilton Nolan would have to say about heavy lifting. I can.
Well, if he denounced it, it'd probably be good for sale. So that's true.
Well,
Hamilton,
there you go.
Pick it up sometime.
Right? Exactly. You never know what wisdom you might find. A word you could find, mock worthy. All right. So listen, I do want to talk about politics, but one of the things that I've been on this sort of kick lately that the news, generally speaking, is covering the circus and kind of ignoring the serious stuff that's going on in other parts of town, so to speak. So we talked earlier in this week about a Turkey and the State Department mandatory military-dependent evacuation from Incirlik Air Base and then a couple of other diplomatic posts. We're talking about 700 individuals, I think, all told, who were told to get out of Turkey. We had a bomb go off today in one of the areas that apparently has been a concern. At the same time, you have Erdogan here in the U.S. He's giving a speech at the Brookings Institution. There's apparently all kinds of foreign policy, says, chaos outside of the Turkish President Erdogan's Washington speech. You had Erdogan's security forces apparently kicking a journalist, a woman thrown to the sidewalk, one journalist physically removed from the event by Turkish security personnel. Okay, so let me just ask you generally, Jim, and I know this is probably going to require a lengthy answer. What the hell's going on in Turkey right now?
boy, oh boy, that's not a easy thing to sum up there. When I did see that story about dependents and civilians being told to get out of southern Turkey, it did send a chill down my spine. For any listeners who don't recall, shortly after I started appearing on your program in 2004, I lived over in Turkey in Ankara from March 2005 to March 2007. I don't know if you thought at the time, Cam, that I was crazy for going over there, but there certainly were enough friends and relatives who were like, is it safe, Jim? Are you sure you want to do it? You and your wife really want to go over there? And it is, just north of Iraq. It is right next to Iran. It is just north of Syria. Was it a safe place for Americans to be? And my sense was, yes, it was. Not that there was zero risk of anything going possibly going wrong, but that generally, if you had to be in the general Middle East region, Turkey was probably the safest country you could pick for Americans, other than maybe argument from the Israelis. Probably an argument from the Israelis, and maybe Jordan or Egypt would kind of argue that the odds were good for an American tourist or American visitors. But it's a different country now. And the fact that the government does this, look, they don't want to have their military personnel away from their families. Incirlik is a very major U.S. air base out there. It was a big part of Operation Iraqi Freedom, a very big part of our airstrikes against ISIL these days. Turkey's a NATO member. We're used to having lots of Americans on their soil and operating, feeling relatively free and secure with the standard kind of precautions you'd make on a foreign military base. The fact they feel like this step is needed is a kind of big, clear indicator. And this is, is building on a series of attacks, sometimes a couple of them in Istanbul, a couple in Ankara, both towards the end of last year and the beginning of this year, showing that violence is really ratcheting up. A big portion of it has been this spillover of refugees and people fleeing the absolute mess in Syria. There is kind of no natural, obvious, clear border between Syria and Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
The Turks do their very best to secure it, but when a flood of refugees comes over the border, you don't have an easy time of sorting out who the good guys are and who the bad guys are. And that has made it a lot easier for ISIL to take strikes like this. And this is a country that, at some point, by the way, Cam, if it this turns into a foreign policy lecture or something, feel free to interrupt me.
Well, listen, I'm fascinated by this. And again, this is the type of stuff that I think, this should at least be on people's radar, because it is unusual, as you say, for the military to take that step. And they're not saying, by the way, when the status could change. It kind of sounds like for the short to medium term, certainly, they're looking at a deteriorating security situation in Turkey where they can't you can never guarantee the safety, but they can't even assume the safety of these individuals.
There obviously are people in our government whose job is to do this. The regional security officers at the State Department, the Defense Intelligence Agency, there are various defense agencies involved in force protection. This is their job, and they would not make a call like this willy-nilly, which indicates that they're seeing, if not something sort of specific intelligence pointing to an attack on a target like this, then just a general atmosphere of more extremists, more chatter, more possibility of attacks like this. And while I was there, so the entire kind of southeastern corner of Turkey has a lot of people called the Kurds in it. Most people remember from the Iraq War, the northern third of Iraq is considered Kurdistan. And the Kurds of Turkey pretty much are tired of being treated as second-class citizens or worse by the Turkish government and a lot of the Turkish people. And there's a pretty strong Kurdish independence movement. There are a lot of Kurds who would like their own country carved out of southeastern Turkey, northern Iraq, and maybe some corners of Syria and Iran. For obvious reasons, the Turkish government does not want this one bit. They consider it to be one of probably the most pressing threat to their national sovereignty and to their national identity. And the Turks tend to crack down on this really, really hard. One consequence of this is a terrorist group called the PKK. They are violent Kurdish separatists. And I remember a Turkish official to me when I was out there describing to me, saying, look, we know you Americans had 9/11. That was the worst day in your modern history. And the death of 3,000 of your citizens strikes you right in your heart. Well, we've had 30,000 people killed as a result of clashes with the PKK over the past couple decades. So think of 10 9/11s, and you know what this means to us. So obviously, you can tell there is a lot of bad blood there. This is a major continuing point of contention there. Now, I was there. You would hear about a bomb going off in a trash can in Istanbul or one of the beach resort towns or something. I don't think there was ever anything huge in Ankara while I was there, other than, this is going to sound like I'm really downplaying things, Cam, other than one attempted suicide bomber in the Justice Ministry. Guy ran in, bomb didn't go off, they tackled him, threw him to the ground, all that kind of stuff. But other than that, no big deal. But then, bit by bit, you did start seeing more attacks after I left. I left in 2007. I know there was a successful bombing both at the U.S. consulate, at the U.S. embassy in Ankara, and an attempted attack on the consulate in Istanbul. The U.S. most consulates in Istanbul used to be kind of in one main stretch, kind of a diplomatic row, similar to what they have in Washington D.C. and most national capitals. Probably about more than a decade ago, the U.S. moved from that main diplomatic quarter to a completely different part of the city, and they built a new embassy, and the entire embassy was built It's not exaggerating to say it looks like a fortress. High walls and clear, obvious, you know, security measures designed to keep people out. And I remember Thomas Friedman writing a column about this, so one of the rare ones where he did not talk. I imagine at some point he must have quoted his cab driver, because that happens in just about every Thomas Friedman column. But the cab driver, whoever he talked to, had said, that place is so locked down, not even the birds fly near it anymore, referring to the U.S. Embassy in Turkey. And you know, this was enough to get Thomas Friedman to crinkle up his mustache and harumph that we were closing ourselves off from the world. And, you know, isn't it terrible that we were in such a paranoid state? I remember thinking, well, it's easy for him to say that. He doesn't have to work there. Right? I mean, you know,
right.
You don't see Thomas Friedman around and say, God, isn't it a shame we have so much security at the New York Times building? And the New York Times D.C. Bureau, you can just walk in. Why can't you just walk in any time you want? You know, it's only lesser security for other people. For him, he needs every bit of security or something like that. And I remember thinking at the time that, I dealt with a lot of folks at the U.S. State Department out there. I had great admiration for them. And I recognized that, look, when you work in a U.S. embassy in the Middle East, you know you are probably on the top, if not top 10, let's say top 25, top 50 buildings that al-Qaeda and other Islamists would like to blow up, right? I mean, you just know it. You are a target for terrorism. And these people got up every morning and went to work and, you know, dealt with the security checkpoints and just kind of recognized this was part of living in the modern world and what they had to do their jobs. Turkey today, I think, you know, this indicator is a sign that this is a bad situation. I know there are probably a lot of members of the Turkish security services who are doing their very best upon this, but yeah, at some point, it's just a matter of volume. And if you have this wall of people coming over from Syria, it makes it easier and easier for the bad guys of ISIS and other extremists who think that bombing is the way to get things done to slip through and be in a position to commit some mayhem.
So I know that Obama said he was not going to speak with Erdogan, wasn't going to have him over to the White House. In light of the fact that the security situation is deteriorating to this point, that U.S. interests are affected here, is that a wise move, Jim?
You know, it's been an odd circumstance. I remember when I was over there, the perception of most U.S. officials towards Erdogan was that, look, this is not the guy we wanted to see with. The shorthand for Erdogan was that he was a moderate Islamist. And if that sounds like a contradiction in terms, you're not alone. But the idea was that Turkey, which had always been this very secular state set up by Ataturk and you know, effectively one-party rule and something of a history of intermittent military coups when they felt like some demagogue was wrecking the separation of mosque and state that had been set up in 1917, that Erdogan was the guy who was starting to make, no, we need more room for what in American eyes might seem like freedom of religion, the freedom to wear a mosque in a government, sorry, to wear a veil or to wear a headscarf in a government building. But a lot of Turks who have dealt with Islamists said, no, this is, if we give you guys an inch, you're going to take a mile. And these were, you know, intensely passionate fights over this. Bit by bit, it became clearer and clearer that Erdogan was more than a little bit of a demagogue himself. He certainly had no problem suppressing freedom of speech, freedom of the press, shutting down newspapers, acting more and more authoritarian, acting more and more autocratic, and kind of wrecking what had been the only, you know, indisputable Muslim democracy on earth, the only one with an indisputable sense of freedom of speech. Or at least a much broader definition of freedom of speech than you'd find in a lot of Muslim countries. A country that was a member of NATO and long time considered, you know, pretty, you know, with some disagreements, pro-Western and a reliable ally. You know, the Turks had fought with the U.S. in the Korean War. Turks had been, you know, allies against the Cold War during the Soviets. They obviously was putting Jupiter missiles in Turkey that started the entire chain of events leading up to the Cuban Missile Crisis. You know, this was a country that had been our ally for a very long time. And with Erdogan in charge, it's less and less clear about that. So I don't mind Obama taking a slightly tougher line towards this. My nagging suspicion is that this is, look, there's less than a year left in Obama's presidency. I don't really see what this is going to do. One way or another, there's going to be a new president in January 2017. And it'd probably be much, that president's probably have a much bigger impact on U.S.-Turkish relations than Obama is.
talking again with Jim Garrity of National Review. All right, Jim. Unfortunately, we're almost out of time here. But let me ask you one question about politics, I suppose. How are you hanging in? I think that's the biggest question you can ask anybody at this point. How are you holding up?
Well, to put it in perspective, you and I, Cam, were chatting on the last day of March. Cam, has there ever been a year where April Fool's Day seemed so superfluous? I mean, like, just take your pick. You know, Trump campaign manager arrested for battery. Any one of the stories you get with Florida man, so to speak. Like, every day is April Fool's Day this year. Every day there's something bizarre and unnerving and strange and weird. My last post over on the corner was observing that the terrible answer Trump gave about abortion, Ben Carson went on CNN. Said, well, no, it's only because he didn't know he was going to be asked that. They didn't warn him he was going to be asked about that. That's why he gave the bad answer. I mean, the great news, Cam, is that when you're president, you always get advance warning of everything bad that's going to happen, right?
Yeah. You get the 3 a.m. phone call, actually, is pre-scheduled.
They call ahead, exactly.
Yeah, so. Exactly. Well, listen, I got to tell you, I saw one of your morning – I see every one of your morning jolts, but there was one the other day that actually prompted me to start a response. So you're going to have a very lengthy email hopefully tonight, maybe at some point tomorrow. I started writing. I haven't been able to stop, so it's up to like 3,500 words now. But you'll get it. Hopefully you'll enjoy it. And just my response to, I think it was your piece about not wanting to hug it out. So look for that in the inbox soon, okay?
Will do.
All right. Jim Garrity from National Review, join us on the program here on NRA News, Cam and Company. James Dellingpole of Breitbart London coming up a little bit later on in the hour. Ash Gow, the Washington Examiner, will join us next hour as well. When we come back after a quick timeout, we're going to talk, as I think we're going to be doing a lot this year, about what's going on in Chicago. The Chicago Tribune reporting that the city is off to its deadliest start in nearly two decades. We saw these headlines last year in Baltimore, Maryland. Now we're seeing them in Chicago. Chicago Tribune writes, as the first quarter of 2016 nears an end, violence in Chicago has reached levels unseen in years, putting the city on course to top 500 homicides for only the second time since 2008. As of 6 a.m. Wednesday, homicides totaled 135, a 71% jump over the 79 killings in the same year earlier period. That represented the worst first quarter of a year since 136 homicides in 1999. Shootings have jumped by comparable numbers as well. As of Wednesday, at least 727 people had been shot in Chicago so far this year, a 73% rise from 422 a year earlier. Worse yet, the Tribune says, that jump follows two consecutive years in which shootings rose by double digits, the analysis found. Homicides also rose by about 12.5% last year over 2014. The Tribune says if there was any hopeful sign in the numbers, it would be that for most of March, homicides rose citywide by a more modest 25% from the same year earlier period, the department said. That's the good news in Chicago right now. Homicides are still over where they were this time last year, but the rate of increase has started to decline a little bit. That's what passes for good news in Chicago right now. So when we come back again after a timeout, we're going to talk about what's going on in Chicago and what can be done to try to turn the tide here. Stick around. We've got more NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, coming up next.
Speaking with Bobby Wiggins with Warrior Outdoors. Welcome to NRA News. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great.
Well, right here on your card, sir, it says Healing for Heroes. That's Tell great. Us, what are you all about? What do you do?
Warrior Outdoors is a nonprofit organization. We are geared towards helping veterans, particularly with post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injuries. We take vets and first responders to on outdoor activities, hunting, fishing, monster truck shows, to paintball, I mean, just anything outdoors to help prevent withdrawal.
How'd you get this started?
I'm actually a service-connected disabled vet myself. I'll go ahead and tell you, my rating with the VA is 70%. when I was medically discharged from the Marine Corps, I did a lot of my own therapy. I signed an inch thick book of papers saying I couldn't talk about this, couldn't see, do anything.
Right.
So I went out to a tree stand with a hunting rifle, and that's where I spent the majority of my time doing my own rehab. So it was like a light switch that clicked and said, I cannot be the only person like this. So I started this organization and built a great team to help me out, and that's now I'm sitting here with you.
That's so awesome. It's great, Bobby, to see you when people do this. And out of necessity, what's born this kind of stuff. So mm-hmm. out of necessity was born Warrior Outdoors, because this is what you had to do for yourself, and now you're doing it for others.
That's correct. Not saying that any other organization out there is bad, because they're all good. It's just we can't have enough organizations like this helping veterans.
Absolutely.
We have 22 veterans a day. Right now, the numbers from the DOD, it's 22 veterans a day committing suicide.
Oh.
One is too many.
How do we get more information about Warrior Outdoors?
You can visit the website, warrioroutdoors.org.
Bobby, thanks for what you do, and thanks for being on NRA News.
Thank you.
Speaking with Bill Poole, he is Managing Director, NRA Education and Training Division. Bill, let's talk about the NRA Basics of Pistol Shooting course. I understand some of it's now available online. Tell us about it.
Yes, John. It's called Blended Learning. That means that part of the course is online. It's about a 7.5-hour online training section that students can complete in the comforts of their own home on their own schedule. And then once they've completed the online or the e-learning module, then they can contact an NRA-certified instructor who will take them to the range and check out their skills, make sure their safe gun handling is at its top, and that their marksmanship skills are just as good as it needs to be.
So this is the NRA Basics of Pistol Shooting course, which is, Bill, such a great course and such a great thing. You guys have kind of jiggered things up a little bit there to make it easier for people to do, right?
It is easier, but I don't want anybody to think that that means that it's shorter or less comprehensive. It's about 7.5 hours of seat time when you take the e-learning module, and then about another 5 hours of time when you go shooting. But the good news is the shooting portion can be all done in one day, in half a day, and so it's going to meet the needs of our students' schedules much better than we've been able to do in the past.
I love it. So then get the book learning part done, then get out there to the range with an NRA certified instructor and finish it all up. It's a great idea, this blended learning course. So, Bill, how can folks get more information about this? How can they sign up? How do they do it?
First step is go to our webpage. It's onlinetraining.nra.org, and I hope they all do it today.
Why should folks check out the NRA Basics of Pistol Shooting course?
It is one of the most vibrant, robust e-learning training courses they're ever going to encounter. There's video, there's 3D pictures. You can listen to it. You can read it. I mean, we've used every modality teachers know how to use. It's an excellent course.
Could have said it better myself, Bill Poole. Thank you so much, sir.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by our friends at Nosler. James Dellingpole of Breitbart London coming up in just a little bit. Ask Gal of the Washington Examiner next hour, along with Rob Port in North Dakota of the Say Anything blog, talking about the student government there at the University of North Dakota actually doing something that we haven't heard from a lot of student governments around the country. It seems like on a lot of college campuses we're seeing student governments try to shut down free speech, try to demand that, demands that must be met. In North Dakota, I suppose you could say that they're doing that same thing. They are telling a professor that she was wrong and that she should apologize when she saw some ROTC students on their way to an on-campus exercise and they had their dummy rifles with them. She called 911. Look, okay, so maybe, whatever. Maybe she flipped out, thought that, something awful was happening, wanted. But after she knew what the story was, she, according to Rob, went on to chew out the ROTC with a profane voicemail message and an ugly letter to the editor of the Grand Forks Herald. And she threatened to call 911 every time she saw ROTC cadets drilling on campus. Since then, by the way, the administration there at the University of North Dakota has said, we will provide better notifications of ROTC events on campus, including personal notifications to this professor. Someone at the university will call this professor every time and say, there's going to be an exercise here on campus, just so you know. Are you kidding me? Again, we'll talk about this with Rob Port of Say Anything Blog. Ash Gow, I don't even think she's, you know, she's going to join us next hour talking about the cottage industry of campus grievance culture. It's not just for students. Oh, no, not by a long shot. Now, before we took a break, we were talking about Chicago, where violent crime is up, homicides on pace for the deadliest year in 20 years, on pace for more than 500 homicides this year. You've got a brand new a superintendent. The Chicago Tribune says on Monday, Mayor Rahm Emanuel passed over the three finalists his handpicked police board had chosen for police superintendent, and instead plucked Superintendent Eddie Johnson from the command post or from the command staff for the post. Johnson said that gang conflicts and the proliferation of guns continue to fuel the violence. The department also disclosed that more than half of the homicide victims so far this year had been targeted as likely gun violence victims or offenders in a novel program in which commanders try to persuade them to give up the gang life. Now, I don't know the particulars of this program. Sounds kind of similar to like the ones we've talked about in Richmond, California, where they give money. Also kind of sounds like the ceasefire programs where there's no money exchange, but there's the promise of help to get out of the gangs. And there's also the promise of going to prison for a long time if you don't clean up your act. So we don't know the particulars of this program. I'm very curious, actually, to know what those particulars might be. But more than half of the homicide victims had been targeted. They had been identified by the city of Chicago as being at risk. They're part of this, was it 6% of the population that is at risk of being victims of violent crime and committing violent crimes. The superintendent said, we know who is committing these crimes. It's a small segment of the population. We have those individuals targeted. One of the things we have to do is ensure we hold those individuals accountable when they commit these crimes. You know, they say that the over half of the homicide victims are in this group. I understand the clearance rate for homicides in Chicago right now is well under 50%. So this is one of the challenges when the superintendent says we have to hold these individuals accountable when they commit these crimes. Right now, it's not happening. More than half the time, it's not happening. But of those individuals who have been arrested and who are facing charges, I'm curious how many of those individuals had been targeted in that novel program in which commanders tried to persuade them to give up the gang life. If it's more than half of the victims, what percentage of the perpetrators that are known to police that have, again, been arrested or at least are facing charges? I'm guessing it's well over 50% as well. So then I guess if you've identified the pool of individuals that are committing these violent crimes, that are victims of these violent crimes, and yet the numbers are going up this year, doesn't that tell you that while you may have identified these individuals, what you're doing to reach them isn't working? I mean, that would be my first conclusion. But there's no indication that they're going to try to change their strategy in dealing with these individuals. Chicago Tribune says back in February, the paper reported a precipitous drop in morale among Chicago police cited in interviews with numerous officers. They told the newspaper that the Laquan McDonald shooting had made them less aggressive on the street out of fear that doing even basic police work would get them into trouble. Criminals were taking advantage of their passive approach, they said. Police department on January the 1st also began requiring cops fill out detailed reports every time they make a street stop as part of a new state law and a landmark agreement worked out with the ACLU. The change, the result of concerns over racial profiling, has not only kept officers busy with paperwork longer than before, officers said, but also increased their anxiety by being second-guessed on whom they've stopped. The result was that officers made 6,818 arrests in January, a 32% drop from the nearly 10,000 arrests a year earlier. The number of street stops has also plummeted, with 9,044 investigatory stop reports issued in January, a fraction of the 61,330 contact cards that police issued during January 2015. The paper says while crime experts and the ACLU have contended that no empirical evidence exists that would suggest the low police activity has led to a rise in violence, an individual with Loyola University expressed concern about officers lying down on the job. A quote, would be remiss in thinking that the apparent lack of police activity has nothing to do with it. That would be foolish to think that. How much? We don't know. Now, the new superintendent said he didn't think morale was so bad, but he said that officers have been confused by the rollout of the new street stop reports. He says that's improved with training. He says we're seeing a steady uptick in the investigatory stops, so we're slowly but surely getting back. I don't think we'll ever hit the numbers we had before, he said, but that's the whole point of it. We just have to make sure that we stop the right people at the right times for the right reasons. Now, the Chicago Tribune also says it's important to keep in mind that the violence is far reduced from the early 1990s, when homicides sometimes exceeded 900 in a year. But, they write, what continues to be troubling is that in recent years, Chicago's violence has outpaced New York and Los Angeles, even though both are more populous. That gulf appears to have only worsened so far this year. The paper also says on Tuesday night, about 20 residents joined several police officers at 71st Street and Jeffrey Boulevard in the South Side's South Shore community in a show of solidarity in the fight against crime. Paper says the area is not as prone to gun violence as it once was, but it still has its flare-ups. The event drew mostly residents who appear to be in their 40s, 50s, or 60s, not the at-risk youths most affected by the violence. Sergeant Medici Joyner, who helped oversee the gathering, says it's hard trying to pull a young person out of that kind of environment where this is what they've eaten, slept, and drank all their lives. You'll get a few, he says, but we don't get them in the volume that we need. You know, again, the police are a part of the strategy to combat this type of violent crime, but they can only be a part of the strategy. The community itself plays a huge role. And those individuals who cared enough, who were in their 40s, 50s, and 60s, who cared enough to show up to make that stand to say, we don't want to see this in our neighborhood anymore. That can't be something that they do for an hour a week. They have to feel empowered to be able to take those concrete steps every day. And sadly, in a lot of these neighborhoods, they don't, because they worry what's going to happen to them if they do. Over on the west side, the Tribune says, the Reverend Ira Acree, an outspoken pastor in the Austin community, talked about fragmented families, a poor school system, and a proliferation of guns as being among the causes of the violence. He said it is a crisis here in Chicago. Unless something radical transpires in our city, there's going to be a bloodbath this summer. It seems to me that this problem has been getting worse. Just going by the statistics here. Again, Chicago has never been a particularly safe city. Its crime numbers did go down along with the rest of the country's. And maybe this is a one-year blip. You know, the homicide rate in Baltimore appears not to be on pace to match last year's, thankfully. But I got to tell you, I think the criminals in Chicago, I saw a story, maybe it was the Guardian this week. They had a story that said handguns can be found for sale on the streets of Chicago for as little as $25. Now, I got to tell you, if that's the case, we're talking about firearms that have never been in the legal chain of commerce whatsoever. If the price of a gun for a gang member, $25, we're talking again about a situation where, you know, these criminals can get a hold of anything that they want illicitly. And apparently very cheaply. So do you try to reduce the supply or do you try to reduce the demand? President Obama yesterday was talking about opioid abuse and the opioid epidemic. And I'm glad to see him talk about it because, again, that's a genuine epidemic in this country. Record high numbers of drug overdoses where, again, when it comes to violent crime, we are, generally speaking, at or around 50-year lows in this country. But the president didn't talk about a supply-side solution to this. He talked about, in fact, he said that would be fruitless, that would be pointless to try to go after it from a supply side. He said you have to reduce demand. You have to reduce the demand for these pills. You have to reduce the demand for the heroin that is available, again, more easily and cheaply than it was 20 years ago. But you have to go after the demand. You have to go after the individuals who are at risk for killing themselves. And you have to deal with them as individuals. Well, again, if the violent crime in Chicago is largely coming from a group of about 6% of the population of that city, and that 6% of the population, again, includes both the perpetrators and the victims, because in many cases they're one and the same, depending on what day of the week it is, you have to deal with them as individuals. You can't expect that passing another gun control law aimed at the law-abiding gun owners is going to impact that 6%. You can't expect that, again, whether it's a gun registration, universal background checks, magazine ban limits, whatever bill it is you're thinking of, you cannot expect that the 6% of the population is going to be impacted by that. Look at their criminal record already. Look at how they are acquiring illegal substances and illegal products and items that they are no longer legally allowed to possess already. They're already operating outside of the boundaries of the law. In many cases, it's because, again, they've never really had to deal with the consequences of their actions. Not the real consequences, not the consequences that are there in statute. They keep getting told they're going to get a break. They better turn their life around. You're running out of chances. You got to turn your life around. Listen, we can't keep doing this. You got to turn your life around. Every time they go before a judge. And again, in that small percentage of the population that is responsible for a disproportionate amount of violent crime, is there in Chicago right now an attempt to actually deal with these individuals in the criminal justice system? Is that where the thinking is right now? Are they leaning more towards, well, you know, we've got to get tough on them? Or are they leaning more towards maybe we're not offering them enough money? That's my biggest question as we look forward to seeing what Chicago looks like in the future here. All right, we got to take a timeout. When we come back, James Dellingpole from Breitbart London is going to join us. Stick around. We've got more NRA News Cam and Company coming up right after this. And I am so thrilled that with us on the program tonight, Mark Wills is with us. Mark, how are you, man?
I'm good, brother. How are you doing?
I am excellent. We were talking during the break. This is not your first rodeo, SHOT Show rodeo, is it?
I think I'm up to about 12, maybe more. 12 SHOT Shows, which is just, it's incredible because, you know, I love the gun industry. I love the this entire experience. It's always a lot of fun. You and I were talking, we go back to the days of when it flip-flopped between Orlando and Vegas here.
Right.
So it's been a lot of fun. We've had a great time.
And to see, you know, not just this event, but to see the industry grow.
Yes.
And, you know, you look back, I mean, even 10 years ago, you know, we've just seen such an explosive growth in terms of who is getting interested in the outdoors.
It's amazing at, you know, when we start talking about freedoms being taken away and we start talking about different, you know, different aspects of our world, how so many people either they run from one direction or the other. They either run, you know, totally run away from it, or they run toward it, and it's been something that I've been able to witness for the last, you know, decade, or the influx of people that really get involved and really love the gun industry and love the technology side of it, and you know they stay involved. It's been really neat.
Yeah, I mean it really has been, and so let's talk about. You mentioned the technology aspect of this.
Yeah.
So this is something that comes up all the time, right?
Okay.
You know, in the gun control debate, why do you need these modern battlefield weapons of war, right? That's how they describe the AR platform or any semi-automatic rifle or pistol.
Correct.
It is a modern battlefield weapon of war. To me, it's kind of like asking, well, why do you need a CD? We've got those Edison wax cylinders, Mark. Why do you need to record, you know, albums so that they can be released digitally when you just have a Victrola?
Well, I don't even make CDs anymore. We go to iTunes. So I mean, that's exactly, you're making a great point. That's something that we've dealt with for a long time. You know, the technology on our side, and now you're getting to see, you know, some of this great technology implemented on the gun side as well. I think it's awesome. But I think that I love my ARs. You know, we don't do a lot of hunting with our ARs, but you know, but we pig hunt. And varmint hunt and stuff like that. You know, most of the rifles that we hunt with are bolt guns. But I love all guns. I really do. Ever since I got my first .22 rifle when I was 5 years old for Christmas, it was a Sears and Roebuck .22, and I still have it to this day. I've fallen in love with the gun world from the time I was a child, and now I'm raising my children. I just took my 13-year-old daughter, who's my youngest daughter, took her for her very first whitetail hunt. She harvested a really nice whitetail. And our reason for hunting is a little different. Our reason for hunting is that my youngest daughter has a dietary issue, that her body doesn't process fat. And that's really how we got into the hunting world, was not being able to go to your grocery store and buy meat, beef, pork, you know, anything like that she could eat because of the fat content. So it's opened up a lot of doors for me and for her to be able to experience some wonderful outdoor time together that has opened her world to being, you know, in love with hunting,
right,
and in love with harvesting her own food. We have both learned an extreme amount about the outdoor world, about, you know, how, you know, a lot of people, they classify hunters as, you know, people that just go out to kill something. And one of the main reasons, one of the main lessons that I taught my daughter right off the bat was harvesting mature animals, not going out and pulling the trigger at the first thing you see. And she learned that lesson on her very first elk hunt. We went to New Mexico, and elk is something that she can eat. Bison is something that she can eat. Venison is something she can eat because of the very, very low fat content in the meat. And so she went out and she watches a hunting show and she thinks, hey man, 22 minutes into this, we got something on the ground and we're on a plane heading back home. Right. And so 4 days into it, and she's like, am I going to get an elk? And we're like, yeah, darling, you gotta calm down. We're going to make this happen. And that was one of the main lessons that she learned off of her first hunt.
Whoa. Welcome back to NRA News. Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Ash Gow, the Washington Examiner. Rob Port of Say Anything Blog in North Dakota Next Hour. Right now, I want to welcome from Breitbart, London, James Dellingpole. James, how are you, sir?
Hey, Cam. Good to be back.
It's good to have you with us. All right, so a couple of things I want to get to here. First of all, what is this that I'm seeing about British gun owners are now all on a registry of some sort? They're all on a watch list just for being a gun owner there in England?
Yeah, I mean, it seems to go in one direction, gun control, that life gets harder and harder for illegal gun owners. Meanwhile, the sort of, you know, if you're a criminal or a terrorist, you get off scot-free.
It is, it's really kind of bizarre what's going on over there. Now, you know, more broadly in the European Union, I realize that Great Britain might not be a part of the European Union for much longer, depending on
well,
how
we
the...
We hope. The, I mean, I fear that the vote will go the wrong way, and we will remain shackled to the corpse that is the European Union. The EU legislation you're talking about is going to we will fall under that legislation, presuming we remain a member of the European Union.
And so, after the attacks in Paris, we saw the EU issue these sort of draft resolutions in which they were calling for, sweeping gun bans, prohibitions on civilian ownership of a lot of common firearms throughout the European Union.
Yeah.
Now it looks like, again, we're still early on in the process, but it looks like there has been some pushback, and there's been some pushback from EU member states where there is still a strong contingent of gun owners, it looks like, James.
Yeah, I'm quite surprised by this, actually. One of the things they were trying to enact was they were trying to classify semi-automatic weapons in the same category as automatic weapons, which would obviously be a real problem for gun owners.
Mm-hmm.
And this was initiated by the European Commission. Now, the commissars of the European Commission are a different entity from the European Parliament. The European Parliament has scrutinized this legislation. And amazingly, weirdly, because I would expect, again, the European Union to always make the wrong decision, they are saying that these proposals have been badly drafted, that they are not fair, that they are unfair on gun owners. So I think there was the possibility that this legislation is going to be amended.
Okay, so if it does get amended, I guess we still don't know what the final version is going to look like, but it's interesting. I mean, the terrorism debate, James, obviously, look, this is not playing out the way it would here in the United States. Right. I don't think you're going to find too many EU states talking about the human right of self-defense and the need for people to be able to defend themselves against these type of attacks. But it does appear that there is still this hesitation of, we don't think that going after the people who've been lawful gun owners all this time is the right way to actually fight ISIS terrorists here in the EU.
Yeah. I mean, the reason that, for example, Britain has some of the most incredibly stringent gun legislation is because you remember there was this massacre at Dunblane where this crazy guy killed some school kids with some guns. And as a result, we banned handguns, for example, which meant that our gold medal-winning Olympic pistol team could no longer legally train in Britain.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the problem. Whenever there is a hideous incident, be it a madman killing kids or whether it's terrorists killing innocent people, you automatically get the legislators trying to have a knee-jerk reaction. But luckily, in this case, we seem to be seeing a degree of common sense from the European Parliament. From this, I'm proud to say an English woman is in charge of the committee, and she seems to be considering this legislation carefully.
That's good to hear. Listen, we are unfortunately almost out of time, but I always appreciate talking with you, James. Thanks so much for coming on the program.
Thanks
and hope we can do it again soon.
Bye-bye.
James Dellingpole from Breitbart London with us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. Coming up top of the hour, since the next hour we're talking about University of North Dakota, we're going to talk with Ash Gow of the Washington Examiner about the cottage industry of campus grievance culture. We'll dip our toes into the waters after a quick timeout. We've got a couple of news items to get to, including more offensive chalking. This time, Cameron, I made a joke about the University of Kansas, Rock Chalk Jayhawk, couldn't use that anymore. Yeah, it's the University of Kansas where they're freaking out now. I'm sorry I said anything. I just maybe kept my mouth shut. Kind of feel partly responsible for this. Plus, we will also talk about the law school, which is honoring the late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. We've got legislative news from around the country to tell you about as well in the next 60 minutes or so, including good news out of the state of Maine and some not so good news out of the state of Hawaii. Plus, we've got an update for you out of California, where opposition to Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom's gun control referendum appears to be growing. And that's a good sign for gun owners as well. Stick around, a busy 60 minutes straight ahead right after a quick break here on this edition of NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler.
News Radio 106.7 in Atlanta, Georgia, the star of the Michael Graham Show.
I'm also the podcast director for the Weekly Standard Magazine. You guys know, I mean, we're in the new media world, whether you're listening on streaming or you're listening on iHeartRadio or on Sirius XM or on Roku. Mm-hmm. You got to get your NRA news.
You do have to.
And
get
it's
up.
So important. The content is so valuable. Even Cam can't screw it up. And that's it's really, when you think about it, that, wow. I mean, I should have started doing this second minute stuff way young, because this... I tank everything I do, so it's easy. What's so funny, too, is I love the fact that I've become a semi-regular kind of guy.
Yeah.
Because even though I grew up with guns, I've had a gun. In fact, I wrote a piece in the Dadley Virtues series of books. Mm-hmm. They did the Dadley Virtues, and then they did the...
Christmas Virtues.
Yeah, this Christmas, right. That was the third.
The Seven Deadly Virtues.
Yeah, the Seven Deadly Virtues. And anyway, so the third one was Christmas, and mine was about the year when I was 9 years old and I got a shotgun. For Christmas. So I've had a shotgun, a little 20 gauge my whole life, had pistols my whole life, but I was so bad at firing them that I rarely, you know, they would take me hunting and my job was to not get killed. That was like, just don't, if we came back and I had no shot to pick out of me, I had done it right. And yet here I am defending the Second Amendment rights of competent people like you who know what you're doing with firearms. I don't. If the fate of civilization rests on me being the last guy with a Glock, we're done.
Well, see, this is the cool thing about this show, is that we get to talk with people like you who support the
incompetent
right.
Incompetent idiots, yes.
Yeah, incompetent idiots. Yes, no, people who support the right, but look, I mean, you'll admit, like, you're not a marksman, right?
No,
but
we
run the spectrum, because there is a spectrum. Not every gun owner in this country has to be Julie Golub, has to be captain of Team Smith & Wesson. You know, not everybody needs to be Kim Rohde, five-time Olympic gold medalist or Olympic medalist. There are people who will get to the range, you know, once every 6 months. There are people who own a firearm, because they want to protect themselves, but they're not marksmen. They're not going to win Top Shot, right? But I know people who aren't even gun owners. They don't own a firearm, but they support the Second Amendment. They are NRA members.
In fact, I think I represent a huge number of people who are thrilled when we have neighbors in our community, or we have members at our church or coworkers who are serious Second Amendment people who take their gun ownership very seriously and practice. I love that, because it's essentially a peace militia in my community. It's good guys with guns, and so I love it. So once again, if you've seen me shoot,
well, you're benefiting.
You'll tell me to put the gun down, but I'll cheer you on. It's the same thing with the military. I do work with a great charity, Fisher House Foundation. It's kind of like Ronald McDonald House.
Awesome charity.
And by the way, unlike the Wounded Warrior dirtbags, they don't blow their money on big salaries and pay celebrities. So Fisher House Foundation, it's like 90-something% goes to the cost.
I donate to them yearly.
Yeah, they're great.
Awesome.
But
So I
do a lot of vet stuff. When I'm with vets, they start talking. And they say, well, what about your experience? Dude, I have no experience. When I was in high school, I took the aptitude military test.
Right.
Yes. And my guidance counselor said, Michael, you are utterly unfit for a military service of any kind. And so she suggested I join the Navy. And I tell that. I get my dad's a sailor. My dad was a sailor. He was in the Navy, so I get to tell that joke. So I'm over in Iraq broadcasting from Baghdad right when things were at their worst, and hanging with these military guys. And I just kept telling, all I can do is cheer. I can only be the cheerleader. That's it. And they're like, oh, no, you'd make a great soldier. After like 5 minutes with me, they go, you know what, just stay away from everything. I get my thumb stuck in grenade things. And
but, you know, I have the same sort of attitude, because I never served in the military. Right. First one of my, family not to, I think, going back to, we missed Vietnam, but every other war since then. And I didn't join the military. But I have, because I didn't join the military, I understand the obligation and the responsibility that I have to support those who right. did.
Welcome back. Hour two of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, starts right now. Ash Gow of the Washington Examiner coming up a little bit later on in the hour, talking about the versus snowflakes. Rob Port of Say Anything Blog up in North Dakota on the snowflake professor who really flipped out over the fact that the ROTC is there on campus at the University of North Dakota. And speaking of flipping out about stuff on campus, I'm sure we're going to see a protest over this. I am sure we will see a protest over this. Nina Totenberg at NPR reporting that the George Mason University is renaming its law school the Antonin Scalia School of Law. Cameron, do you think the protests have already started there on the campus at George Mason University?
Yeah, as a sometimes proud George Mason alum, I get more and more disappointed at what I see on my campus. But this is the law school is not the main campus. They have it's separate from the main campus is in Fairfax, Virginia. The law school is in Arlington, Virginia, and there's fewer students. So maybe that is will work towards their favor. It's harder to park. It's more of an urban setting. Maybe it'll be harder to organize. You don't have big places to gather. But yes, the protests will be furious for sure.
Here, let's see. Here's from Blue Virginia. It's bad enough that GMU's Mercatus Center is a coke-sucking far right-wing organization, but now this. Let me remind everyone that Antonin Scalia was a corrupt, bigoted extremist, writes Blue Virginia. Why would anyone in their far-right mind want to name anything after that guy, let alone a law school? Has GMU gone completely off its rocker or what? Or, as Think Progress Justice editor Ian Milheiser puts it, GMU can, quote, now stop pretending to be anything other than a conservative policy shop with students. Ugh, says Blue Virginia. Yeah. So if this were to be named, I don't know, the, I know she's still with us, but the Ruth Bader Ginsburg School of Law, since she and Scalia were good friends on the bench, would, I know again what a lot of conservatives would say, but would Ian Milheiser, the justice editor, at Think Progress, would he say, well, you know, shoo, because yeah, this is just a liberal policy shop with students, so it's good that we know this. Or would he say, this shows maturity and balance, all kinds of, there'd be all kinds of superlatives. So, yes, I'm sure that we will see protests. Frankly, Cameron, you talk about the fact that the law school is not there on the campus in Fairfax. I'm not sure a lot of the protesters know that. We may actually see some confused protesters wandering around Fairfax, Virginia. Where's the law school?
Just something to protest. God forbid somebody writes something about chalk, about the Antonin. If Antonin Scalia shows up on chalk in the Johnson Center at George Mason University, it's a time to riot.
Maybe that's how they'll put up the signage. They'll just write it in chalk, and that'll make it like doubly bad.
Stick it to him.
Alex Griswold over at Mediaite says a week after Emory University's administrators set up counseling sessions after Donald Trump 2016 chalkings were found across campus, students at the University of Kansas complained after similar chalkings were found on their campus. Shigufta Huma, vice president of the University Senate, was the first to complain and publicize the chalkings, asking, is this the post-racial paradise folks pretend exists? Again, it said Trump 16 in chalk. Let's see. Other tweets highlighted by Alex Griswold. The privilege is having the audacity to do this as a joke because it doesn't actually harm folks, right? Actually, yeah, it doesn't actually harm anybody. I didn't realize that was up for debate. Unlike Emory, KU staff reacted to the angry students fairly calmly.
explaining that it wasn't necessarily a student who made the chalkings, and that students were allowed to make Trump chalkings if they wanted to, or Bernie Sanders chalkings, or Hillary Clinton chalkings, or someone who's dropped out. Still do a Rand Paul chalking if you wanted to. The University of Kansas responded to Ms. Gupta's tweet specifically saying, just because there is chalk on campus doesn't mean a Jayhawk did the chalking, Shagufta. To which another individual asked the KU Twitter feed, would Trump 2016 have been approved if by a student? And the university says, yes. Here's the policy. So here's the policy for bulletin boards, posting of materials, and sidewalk chalking policy on from the Office of the Provost and Executive Vice Chancellor. Again, it's different for bulletin boards, but they do have a 5-point regulation on sidewalk chalking there at the University of Kansas, because of course they do. University units and student and campus organizations that are registered with the Student Involvement and Leadership Center are permitted to chalk on the property of the university or its affiliate organizations in order to publicize events that they are sponsoring or to promote student participation in university events. Any other individual or group wishing to chalk on the property of the university or its affiliated organizations must obtain permission in advance from the University Events Committee. Chalking is permitted on horizontal, paved, concrete, uncovered campus sidewalks. Only water-soluble, dry-stick sidewalk chalk may be used. Aerosol spray chalk is not permitted. Lots of other places where chalking is not permitted. All other chalking is subject to immediate removal, and the individuals or groups responsible may be charged the cost of the cleanup. A member of the university community who chalks on the property of the university or its affiliated corporations in violation of this policy is subject to applicable university disciplinary proceedings. Any person who is not a member of the university community and who chalks in violation of this policy on the property of the university or its affiliate organizations also may be charged with a violation of a criminal offense under state law for criminal damage to state property for said chalkings. So, I got to tell you, honestly, like, reading that policy, I don't actually know that Trump 2016 is covered. I hate to say it, but I don't know that it is. Because listen again to what's allowed to be chalked. There are certain messages that are allowed to be chalked, and only certain messages are allowed to be chalked. You've got to be registered with the Student Involvement and Leadership Center, or you have to obtain permission in advance from the University Events Committee, and you are allowed to chalk in order to publicize events that university units, student and campus organizations that are registered with the Student Involvement and Leadership Center are sponsoring or to promote student participation in university events. And that's it. Now, the presidential election is not a university event. Right? So, I mean, I'm glad to see University of Kansas saying, like, everybody calm down. But I'm not actually sure that this fits in their chalking policy. Because there's nothing in there about anything other than university events. So maybe the speech code needs to be revised a little bit. Now, Alex Griswold says the university response angered Rock Chalk Invisible Hawks, the black advocacy group on campus. He says that's actually worse. That you wouldn't do anything. Who will intervene? That means that we're not teaching Jayhawks that bigotry is unacceptable. You could have used that chance to denounce that Trump propaganda, they said. Instead, you used it to be defensive. Now, Griswold says the chalkings were eventually erased not because of the message, but because the chalker did not go through the proper channels beforehand. Remember, again, if you're not a member of the pre-approved list of groups who can chalk, then you have to get pre-approval for your message. But I got to tell you, I mean, that 5-point chalking regulation, you actually want to follow the letter of the regulation. No, I don't think that political chalkings in support of political candidates, I don't think would be allowed, which, by the way, I think is kind of stupid. And just as we saw at Emory University, Young Americans for Liberty came out, held a chalking protest of their own, chalked up campaign slogans for all of the candidates out there, the university president trying to, I think, undo some of the damage after offering counseling sessions for people who might have been offended by seeing the Trump 2016 chalkings there on campus, chalked a message of his own that Emory University stands for free expression. Maybe Kansas should take a page from what they're now doing at Emory University. But again, there is no shortage of these types of stories. And according to Ash at the Washington Examiner, we're going to talk with Ash Gow here in a couple minutes. One of the reasons why we are not seeing a shortage of these types of stories is because there is, in fact, a cottage industry. There is there's the promotion of this type of thinking and this type of behavior, and you shouldn't expect to see it get any better anytime soon. But we'll talk about this more with Ash Gow coming up here in just a little bit. Now, we've talked in recent shows here about what's going on in California with Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom and his gun control referendum. He wants to put it on the ballot. Has until, I think, June to gather the requisite number of signatures. And there is already opposition in a pretty diverse group of opponents here under the banner of the Coalition for Civil Liberties. The California State Sheriff's Association recently came out in opposition to these proposals, saying that they would not be helpful to law enforcement, that they're aimed in the wrong direction, that they're targeting law-abiding citizens who are not the problem, and that this is unnecessary and unneeded. Well, now, the Western State Sheriff's Association and the Law Enforcement Action Network have also officially opposed the gun control referendum, which, by the way, has the title, because of course it does, the Safety for All Act of 2016. Yeah. Just like the New York Safe Act and the Maryland Firearms Safety Act, right? See, gun control doesn't poll well. They've had to rebrand. It's not about violence prevention anymore. It's not about reducing gun violence. Now it's gun safety, common sense gun safety, common sense gun safety reform. So you don't even have to say law. And you're not, I mean, that's about as far away from gun control as you could get, right? Common sense gun safety reforms. Except that the proposals are still the same old tired gun control proposals. Actually, they're not even gun control proposals. They're just anti-gun proposals and anti-gun ownership proposals. So the Western State Sheriff's Association represents sheriffs and their command staff, not just in California, but across 15 different states. The Law Enforcement Action Network is a nonprofit organization whose mission statement is to fight against policies that favor criminals at the expense of the police and the public. Now, Gavin Newsom, you know, he's serious about this. He's kind of using this as one of his springboards, maybe the primary springboard in his gubernatorial campaign, because he's running for governor. So he's going to enlist the help of the Hollywood celebrities, you know, the ones who show up for the Everytown video shoots and the Brady campaign galas in Los Angeles. They'll, I'm sure, write some checks. I am sure that they will make a video or two. They'll try to put their talents to use for this referendum, again, called the Safety for All Act. But the people who will actually be charged with enforcing these laws or these proposals, those who feel like they can speak up without possibly losing their job, those whose primary role in their profession is, again, to help ensure that violent crime is as low as possible, to deal with the criminals in our midst, to take them off of the streets, to build up a case that can be taken to prosecutors who can then hopefully put violent criminals behind bars for a long period of time, a lot of these individuals, again, who are actually working within the criminal justice system, who, again, feel like they can speak out, are speaking out. The Coalition for Civil Liberties doesn't just include folks like the California State Sheriff's Association or the Western State Sheriff's Association. You've got prosecutors who are involved in the effort because, again, they know that they have a finite amount of resources. And frankly, it's a shrinking number that we're talking about here. That they are already tasked with a caseload in a system that demands most of these cases get plea bargained down. And every hour that is spent going after an otherwise law-abiding gun owner because they possessed a magazine that the state told them they weren't allowed to possess is an hour that they are not spending on someone who is an actual real threat to the public safety of Californians. Los Angeles Deputy District Attorney Michelle Hennessy is a co-chair for the Coalition for Civil Liberties. She had a piece in the Orange County Register. Now, keep in mind, again, here's a prosecutor. She said the centerpiece of Newsom's proposal would require a license to sell and a background check just to buy a box of ammunition. This, she says, would require the creation of another complicated, expensive, and inevitably flawed database, which California officials will be unable to effectively maintain. New York already tried this approach, abandoned it after wasting millions of public dollars. His proposal would confiscate all magazines that hold more than 10 rounds. But Californians have already been prohibited from buying these magazines for nearly two decades. The cities of Los Angeles and Sunnyvale tried to confiscate the remaining stock, requiring citizens to surrender legally obtained private property. Not one person complied. The only way to enforce this law is by pulling police from the streets and putting them into the homes of people who pose no threat. Newsom also seeks the mandatory reporting of stolen or lost firearms. Governor Jerry Brown vetoed the same proposal in 2013 for good reason. Quote, I am not convinced that criminalizing the failure to report a lost or stolen firearm would improve identification of gun traffickers or help law enforcement disarm people prohibited from possessing guns. I continue to believe that responsible people report the loss or theft of a firearm and irresponsible people do not. Prosecuting this, says the prosecutor, also would be practically impossible. Another key element, she says, of Newsom's plan is to make the theft of any firearm into a felony. Ironically, she said, it was another Newsom initiative, Proposition 47, which reduced the theft of guns valued under $950 to a misdemeanor. She says law enforcement agencies and officials agree with this aspect of the proposition, but it's curious that Newsom's only original idea is a refutation of his previous work. Yeah. She writes, Newsom, who travels with armed bodyguards, put forward his proposition without coordination from other political leaders. Even Democrats like Governor Brown and Senate President Pro Tem Kevin DeLeon, who, by the way, no friend of gun owners, do not support Newsom's approach. California's legislative leaders are busy considering crime bills while Newsom is circumventing them. California has the most restrictive gun laws in the nation, she writes. But the recent terrorist attack in San Bernardino shows us that laws do little to stop the lawbreakers. The only way that we're going to make progress against violence is through a cooperative effort of law enforcement, legislators, the private sector, and individual citizens who can take some responsibility for their own safety. Self-serving political schemes like Newsom's initiative, she says, will only set us back. So if you are a California gun owner, I know we've got a lot of them out there listening. Make sure you get involved here with the Coalition for Civil Liberties. This is something that you absolutely can do this election year and make a difference because while the signatures have not yet been turned in, we don't know that this is going to be on the ballot. Act like it is and start planning now. All right, when we come back after a quick break here on this edition of NRA News Cam and Company, our friend Ash Gow of the Washington Examiner talking about the college snowflakes. They keep finding a new low here, which is Hard to do, and it's only March. We still have a couple more months left of school around the country. Stick around. We've got more NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, right after this.
Speaking with Jose Morales, NRA training counselor. Jose, welcome to NRA News. We want to talk about the three rules of firearm safety. What are those?
Thank you very much for having me. The three NRA safety rules. The first one, the primary rule, is always keep the gun pointed in a safe direction. Now, what that means is we want to make sure that if that gun discharges by accident, that it's in the safest direction possible, the direction it will cause if the gun were to discharge, the least amount of property damage, the least amount of possibility of injury possible. And it's our responsibility to make sure that we never point the muzzle, which is the front of the barrel, at anything we don't want to shoot, including ourselves.
Okay. Rule number two.
Rule number two is always keep your finger off the trigger until you're ready to fire, which is common sense, but as my mother says all the time, common sense is not that common. We need to make sure that our finger in my pretend gun is on the side of the gun, away from the trigger guard at all times. And our finger only enters the trigger guard when we're ready to shoot, and as soon as we're done, it's removed immediately and always kept alongside of the gun, preferably on the frame.
Okay. And what's rule number three?
Rule number three, always keep your firearms unloaded until you're ready to use them. So the moment you pick up a firearm, you have to make sure that if they have any manual safeties, they're engaged. Open up the action, remove the magazine, visually and physically inspect to make sure that there's no rounds in the chamber, and then you are ensured that the gun is empty.
Jose Morales, NRA training counselor, let's go over those three rules again. Number one.
Absolutely. Always keep the gun pointed in a safe direction. Number two is always keep your finger off of the trigger until you're ready to shoot. And number three is always keep the gun unloaded until you're ready to use it.
All right, the three rules of firearm safety. How can we get some more information about this?
Just check on nrainstructors.org for a comprehensive list of classes, and we'd love to see people take more of them.
Jose, why is it important that we observe these three rules of gun safety?
As I tell my students and gun enthusiasts and budding gun enthusiasts, guns are incredibly safe. We are the ones that are unsafe. We are the ones that make accidents happen. And if you follow all three safety rules all the time, not when you remember, not when you feel like it, but all the time, it is literally impossible to have an accident.
I want a woman president, but I want an honest president more. I want someone who can place their hand on a Bible and swear to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution without telling a lie. Someone who believes in the integrity of that office. A president whose actions reinforce the moral lessons I teach my children. There are many powerful, accomplished women in both parties who meet and exceed that standard. But you, Mrs. Clinton, are not one of them. Your past is littered with shameful, dishonest behavior, decades of decisions that point toward your own power and fortune, not the best interest of women, the country, or the truth. There is no greater threat to my freedom than another dishonest president. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
I'm a good person. I never bothered anybody. But I can't afford a nice house in a safe neighborhood. I live in a government high-rise. Gangbangers and drug dealers walk down our halls every day. My neighbors and I were scared. We called the police, but they can't keep us safe. Some of us are too afraid to even leave our apartments. But the housing authority told me if I bought a gun to protect myself, they'd throw me to the streets. If I'm not free because of my address today, what makes you think you'll be free tomorrow? I marched behind Martin Luther King at Selma. I know my rights. Now I have my gun. I am the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company. Oh, Cam, I'm pretty sure this music is just a microaggression to college students. At least some college students. Rob Port of Say Anything blog talking about what's going on at the University of North Dakota regarding a college professor there who apparently does not like ROTC at all. Right now, I want to welcome from the Washington Examiner, our friend Ash Gow. Ash, how you doing?
Doing great. How are you?
I am good, but I'm not a college student these days, so I've got that going for me.
Yeah, it's definitely not safe on campus for, anyone who's there to actually learn, apparently.
I guess. I mean, you've got a couple of pieces I want to talk about, but you had a column yesterday, the cottage industry of campus grievance culture. Someone said something you don't like, report them. Someone you don't like flirted with you, report them. Regret that drunken hookup, report that person. You know, we talk a lot about the problems with freedom of expression, people being disinvited to campuses, ideas not being allowed to exist on college campuses. But, I mean, you've got this piece about the micromanaging of students' dating lives, of their sex lives. The campus seems like a place where you have different groups of people just trying to control other groups of people. And then you've got, it seems, a fairly large but fairly quiet body of students and faculty who actually just want to do what they're there to do.
Right, and they're afraid to speak up. A few of them are brave enough to, but a lot of them think that they're going to be, punished academically, whether they might get a bad grade or be treated differently in class or shamed out of school, even. I mean, the way that the activists have worked is that if you don't agree with them, then you have to go. And they've done that with campus administrators. They have done that with some students. Then, there's just this, they're creating this culture of fear that their way is the right way. And the tactics they use to get everybody in compliance are basically, as Ben Shapiro puts it, the tactics of fascists.
But there is, as you point out, what I think is fascinating here is that you point out that there are people who are, making a living off of this. There are people who want to see this continue.
Right. I mean, there's one group out there charges, $50,000 to come onto campus and, teach them, give a lecture basically on how they should adjudicate these things. And they kind of add in some due process with some of it. But that's $50,000. I mean, these people are making bank on this entire industry, and the schools are paying for it, which is passed on to the students in higher tuition. So these students that want free college from Bernie Sanders, this is why it's so expensive, is you guys basically keep asking for more and more and more, and then whine and complain when the tuition goes up. Because we're not, not teaching economics anymore in high school or college? I mean, it wasn't a requirement at my school in Massachusetts, which, was a mentality of the students coming from there. But economics was a course that I would have had to take in Florida at high school.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you're just kind of seeing this starting in high school. They just haven't been.
Talking again with Ash Gow, the Washington Examiner. Whoop, I think we might have lost you there, Ash. You back with us?
Tuition's too high, but you don't want any of the things you like cut.
Well, no, you don't want any of the things that you like cutting. You have to make sure that there's still, a gluten-free whatever in the dorm room cafeterias. We have to make sure that, sushi night is still on Monday night. I mean, all of the – remember, going back even a couple of years ago, there were a glut of stories about the money that colleges were spending trying to attract college students, right? So we needed a rock climbing wall. We needed all these cool things to attract college students. But now, it doesn't really matter what shiny objects you have if you don't feel comfortable, being on campus, because, one wrong move and all of a sudden your life is ruined, right? Or even not a wrong move, just nothing. You did nothing wrong and all of a sudden your life is ruined. You speak out, you express an unpopular opinion, and all of a sudden it's the end of the world. I'll be honest with you. I don't care what kind of stuff the campus has, if it's not a place where people are going to feel free to speak their mind and to do what they're there to do.
Right, exactly. I mean, in all of these issues on campus, I mean, what is this thing that's missing? Is actual learning and actual education. These students are whining and complaining about things they don't like. Chalk on the ground, the names of buildings, things that other people say when they disagree with them or have a viewpoint that runs counter to their worldview. And they're complaining about these kinds of things. And it says, where do you find the time to be outraged about all of this when you should be in class and studying.
Oh, but Ash, we've seen, what was it? Was that Brown University? That probably more than just Brown, where students say, listen, I'm upset about these events that are in the news. If there are, you know, other protests that have been taking place nearby, I'm upset about what's going on here. I can't go to class. I can't take my test. We need to cancel midterms. We need to cancel finals because we're too emotionally wrought over a particular story. We're already seeing that on campus.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, maybe this whole thing is about trying to get out of class. I mean, I can't come to class. I was protesting, or I can't come to class because I'm upset about something. And it's just, and then if the teacher there says, no, that's, you know, no, you're not traumatized by something going on in the news unless you are directly affected by it. You need to come to class. You need to grow up. And then suddenly there's calls for that teacher to resign. We saw that at Mizzou. There was a popular professor who refused to cancel a class during all of these, the outrageous protests happening there. And tons of students were calling for him to resign, and he tried to, but the school was like, no, no. But like, that was kind of where Mizzou finally drew the line.
Okay, so you talk about Mizzou drawing the line, and at Emory University, again, after originally hosting counseling sessions for students who were upset about the chalking of Trump 2016 on campus, the president joined with students from Young Americans for Liberty and chalked himself that Emory University stands for free expression. Are we starting to see some pushback, and is this pushback coming from not necessarily students on campus, but from alumni, from donors, from people who can hit these universities in their purse strings?
I think that's where where it has to come from. I mean, I think that's what kind of happened at Mizzou, where they saw some of it was from prospective students. They had the lowest, you know, they're going to have the smallest freshman class, I believe, next year because their admissions just kind of dropped. People don't want to go to a school like that where there's just protesters are just whining about everything, where you're not going to be able to walk to class without seeing somebody yelling at you to get on their side or else. So you've got that. But you've also, I believe, some donor pushback, some issues there where, you know, if alumni don't want to give money into seeing schools allowing students to take over the place, like students, they're there to learn, and yet they're now in charge. They have the faculty job in their hands when it is not supposed to be that way. The adults are supposed to be in charge, but now the students are.
Yeah, this is a weird thing where, you know, you're paying upwards of, in some cases, I think Emory is over $60,000 a year. You're paying over $60,000 a year to try to teach somebody. Right, to try to teach your professors, to try to teach your college president, to try to teach these administrators a thing or two. It used to be that, you know, Ash, if you were forking over that kind of money, you'd want to get your money's worth. You'd want to sit there and be a little sponge absorbing all kinds of information, right?
Right.
I don't get it. But, you know, it troubles me. And I don't think that this is being overblown. There's a piece at the LA Times today, Howard Gilman and Erwin Shimerinsky, teaching a freshman seminar on freedom of speech on college campuses, they write, has made us aware of the urgent need to educate the current generation of students about the importance of the First Amendment. From the beginning of our course, we were surprised by the often unanimous willingness of our students to support efforts to restrict and punish a wide range of expression. Not a single student in the class saw any constitutional problem with requiring professors to give trigger warnings before teaching potentially disturbing material, they write. According to the William F. Buckley Jr. Program at Yale, 72% of students support disciplinary action against, quote, any student or faculty member on campus who uses language that is considered racist, sexist, homophobic, or otherwise offensive. Too few students, they write, grasp that one person's offense can be another's expression of truth to power. I mean, this is the thing. We're not, at the end of the day, Ash, we're not talking about hurt feelings, because you're going to have hurt feelings. As you say, as a grown-up, someone's going to hurt your feelings. As a kid, someone's going to hurt your feelings all the time. The answer is not to try to change the world so that nobody is capable of hurting somebody else's feelings. The answer is to change yourself so that someone else's insults kind of roll off of you, because you know that they're just the insults of a small little person, and they're not worthy of you absorbing what they have to say. Instead, we've gone to that other extreme here, and now we are trying to police the world and try to police the speech. At the end of the day, what we are trying to do is restrict the ability of people to talk.
Right, absolutely, because if you can't even, you could never have a debate because you're both on a different side of an issue, and if the other side of the issue offends you, then you can't come to some kind of agreement. It's just my way or the highway type reasoning at this point. And, you know, I've talked to students on colleges, and they say when they try to make these positions seem reasonable, they're saying, well, what's wrong with people speaking decently to each other? But that would be fine. Everybody should speak decently to each other. But when you're constantly redefining what decent is, mm-hmm. and everything that you personally do not like becomes indecent, whereas the person right next to you can agree with you on so many things and they might find something else indecent. It's like you don't get to decide what is indecent. And the reason for that is because if everybody could define that, then everybody would be in jail.
It's amazing how, you know, the dominant school of thought, maybe, you know, for the last 30 years or so on college campuses has been this sort of cultural relativism, right, where there is no great universal truth. And every idea should be considered and should be thought, you know, on its own merits. But there's no one universal truth. What's true for you, Ash, might not be true for me. Now, all of a sudden, and maybe I shouldn't say all of a sudden, but over the last 5 years or so, there has been that sort of seismic shift of, oh, yeah, no, there actually is objective truth, and it's what we believe. And if you don't believe what we believe, well, then you're just wrong, and you should be shunned, and we don't want you here. We don't want you here on this campus.
Right. And these students don't seem to grasp how, you know, it could be used against them, or how they have no clue in their mind that they might not be right, that their hurt feelings might not actually be because of a crime, because of an offense. They might just be overly sensitive. They just can't fathom that. That if their feelings are hurt, that it's not that they should just buck up, but it's that somebody else has done something actually wrong. And they just don't understand.
Does it ever make you want to sneak onto a college campus with some chalk there, Ash?
Absolutely. And just write, you know, facts don't care about your feelings, or feelings are not facts. And just, you know, grow up. You're here. You are actually adults. You can vote. You can buy cigarettes. You can't legally drink yet, most of you. But you are adults, and you need to act like them. Because when you get off a college campus, your employer is not going to provide you counseling because you saw a flyer on a street that you didn't like.
I'm surprised you haven't asked the examiner for counseling after having reported all of these stories. I imagine you're pretty troubled.
Maybe I should, and then report what they say.
Listen, I always appreciate you coming on the program. We love what you're doing. Thank you for covering these stories, because I think they are really important. And look forward to talking to you again very soon.
Yeah, definitely. Always have fun talking to you.
Me too. We'll talk again very soon. Ash Gow joins us from the Washington Examiner. When we come back here after a quick timeout on NRA News, Cam and Company, Rob Port of Say Anything blog, going to talk about what's going on in North Dakota. And then I want to get back to this article by Erwin Chemerinsky. Not a fan of the Second Amendment there, is Erwin. He's at the UC Irvine School of Law. He's the founding dean of the UC Irvine School of Law. Howard Gilman is the chancellor and professor of law, political science, and history at UC Irvine. And they talk about, again, their experience with this freshman seminar of students, most of whom, they say, have no idea about why we have a First Amendment. They have no idea about the fight for the freedom of expression in this country, throughout this country's history. And they have no real desire to protect the freedom of speech, unfortunately. It's a very sobering look at least one college class. Take a quick time out here with us. We'll be right back with more NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, right after this.
You know, one of the things, too, that has really gone hand in hand and huge opportunity for Narissa and I, who are avid hunters, is our TV show, Universal Huntress. We're actually moving to Saturday nights this year on Pursuit, and we are able to go out. There's a need for something in the hunting industry, we're going to know. We spent 200 days in our first prototypes for our hunting line and came back and were able to go, I don't like this, I want this changed. You know, Narissa had her flair, I had my flair, and the things that we were able to do. You know, it's just been a blessing to be able to have those opportunities. And now we actually showcase and feature on the show our hunting line and what we're doing to grow it, to change it. And you're going to see that a lot this year in season 3.
I believe that's called synergy. A lot more behind the scenes this year?
Yeah, a lot more behind the scenes.
You're going to get a little sneak peek into GWG's world behind the scenes. And, of course, we also have our producer, Emmanuel Kapp, and he has Universal Hunter Magazine. I write in the magazine every month different articles from where we hunt and, you know, showcasing us from anywhere from a North American hunt to Argentina to New Zealand to Africa.
That is amazing. You all have just the coolest life and, the like I said, the greatest story. But you know, here's the thing. You've earned it, and you've worked for it. And I want to talk about that, if we can, for a second, because, you know, look, we live in an environment now where it's not the easiest thing to start your own business. It never is. But, you know, there are a lot of hurdles and impediments along the way, and yet you have done this. You've gone from a dream. And you've put in the sweat equity and you've made this a reality. Can you talk about some of the qualifications? What do you need? What are some of the tangibles and intangibles that a person has to have in order to take that idea? We all come up with great ideas all the time, but it's executing them, it's turning them into that reality. What do you need and what have you had to rely on to make Girls with Guns such a success?
You know, I would say the biggest thing right here, right now, would be the person for me sitting next to me, a partner, somebody that believes in you and that you believe in them, and you work together every day. Narissa and I are as opposite could be, with all the same beliefs, drive, and ambition. And so I'm the business side of GWG. I run everything from our e-commerce site and website, have a staff of 11 under me, and just love to do work with our sponsors, writing, things like that. Narissa is this fashion-forward person who loves to go shopping, and that sounds horrible to me, and get into... You talk a little bit more about what you like to do.
Yeah, I mean, you know, just the creative side. I love it. But, you know, if we could give any advice out there is, you know, just go after it. If you believe and you love and you're so passionate about your brand, you know, anything is possible. And as long as you have drive and, you know, your vision, just stay focused. And if you have good friends and good family, you know, their support is amazing. I mean, Cam, who would have ever thought that we would be here? I remember the first time you interviewed us, I couldn't even talk.
She was so nervous.
I was sweating. I mean, I'm probably sweating right now, but I mean, just, you know, just to see this and to share this with our fans and everybody is amazing. And, you know, this opportunity is fantastic. So we hope anybody out there wanting to start a brand, you know, go get after it. Yeah. Girl power.
Girl power. Well, as I said, it has been... it's been a lot of fun, and it's been really exciting to watch the growth and to get a chance to interview you a couple of times a year. We try to catch up at SHOT Show, at the NRA annual meeting, and every time it's, all right, tell me about your latest adventures. What have you been doing, you know, for the last 6 months? And you always have something cool going on. so, I mean, I don't know, do you sleep at all? How do you do this at this point?
No,
you've got the you've got the Girls with Guns clothing line, you've got the business, as you say, then you've got the TV show, and you're constantly looking to add more and more. Do you have time to just stop and take a breath and just enjoy all of this, or are you just enjoying the ride at this point?
You know, for me, I love the ride. I'm very high energy, and I really don't sleep a whole lot. It is just an amazing journey, and how can you? I mean, you know, I figure I'll sleep when I'm dead because I'm going to take all of this in. My favorite part and the only time where I disconnect and shut down and literally am at one with nature is when I hunt.
Mm.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Coming up top of the hour, hero of the day, deal of the day, good guy of the day, Rob Pincus of the Personal Defense Network, talking about the Gawker piece. Guns won't protect you, old people. You're too old and weak. Yeah, honest to goodness headline. Great days for journalism right now. We are also following a breaking story out in Richmond, Virginia. Apparently, police were at a training exercise at the Greyhound station there in Richmond when a suspect opened fire on officers. At least two Virginia State Police have been hit. I'm seeing conflicting reports of additional injuries, so we're going to keep an eye on that situation. But again, at least two police officers hit, at least one civilian injured as well. The suspect is dead. The Virginia State Police were on the scene, again, conducting a training exercise when these shots were fired. So we'll try to bring you more information about that as details come in here. Meanwhile, I want to welcome to the program Rob Port of Say Anything Blog up in North Dakota. Rob, how you doing today, sir?
I'm doing good.
It's great to have you with us. I had a lot of people over the last couple of days send me this story out of the University of North Dakota. This professor who, was this last weekend, saw these ROTC cadets on campus there and flipped out?
It was about 2 weeks ago. And the actual incident happened before that. What kicked it off is she apparently saw some ROTC students on campus who were walking to an exercise that was to take place on the quad. They had some dummy weapons, some fake guns, basically, that they used during their exercises on campus with them. She saw them. She became alarmed. She called 911. Up to that point, maybe a reasonable reaction. I mean, shootings are something that happen. You see somebody, you think maybe they've got a real gun. You don't know what's going on. Maybe calling 911 at that point isn't unreasonable. However, she's informed by the 911 operator that it's an ROT exercise, at which time she becomes irate. She calls and leaves a voicemail for the ROTC commander with profanity, saying that she felt terrorized. She then writes a letter to the Grand Forks Herald, the local newspaper, basically accounting the whole thing and saying that she plans on calling 911 every single time she sees an ROTC drill on campus, basically because they make her feel terrorized I guess they're violating her safe space.
Now, you point out at your website that the University of North Dakota administration has promised there will be better notification campus-wide of any ROTC events, and this includes, you say, personal notifications to the professor?
Yeah, that's right. That was one of my first questions was, did they send out some sort of a notification? Because, I think that's a reasonable expectation to have, that if they're going to be having something like that going on campus, that they send everybody out a heads up so everybody's on the same wavelength. The issue is though is that they did send out the notice that the ROTC was going to be out there after the incident. I emailed UND spokesman Peter Johnson, and he said basically yes, we sent an email. But what they're going to start doing is sending a notification before each individual exercise. And then he said, I quote, "We will also notify the faculty member each time there will be exercises." So I guess she's going to get her own personalized notification.
That is amazing. That is amazing. Meanwhile, though, you report that the Student Senate there at the University of North Dakota voted unanimously, 17-0, passing a resolution, quote, supporting the ability of the campus ROTC program to conduct exercises on campus and also asking for the professor to publicly apologize for the comments that she had made to Lieutenant Colonel Carroll. What specifically were those comments? Was that about how she felt terrorized every time she saw the ROTC, or was there more, Rob?
Yeah, well, she left a voicemail, and if you go to sayanythingblog.com, I've got a link to if you want to listen to the audio of the voicemail message. But she gets pretty profane. She says it's ridiculous. She calls the exercises unnecessary. In an email exchange, a lot of the emails were requested public record through from the Grand Forks Herald. In the emails, the commander, Lieutenant Colonel Carroll, basically said that I feel like you're behaving unprofessionally, because she's basically cursing the guy out. I mean, she's using profanities left and right, and I think that was sort of the student's point as well. And the students actually put in the resolution, they didn't feel like she was necessarily in the wrong to call 911 It's just her reaction after the fact when she learned that it was the ROTC and she cursed them out and she's threatening to call 911 all the time. They felt that that was unprofessional.
I think that it probably was. Now, has there been any response from the professor? I know you say that she has since backed off some of her comments, but any indication that she will, in fact, apologize?
Well, you know, after the initial sort of backlash to her letter to the editor, you know, she told the media that, you know, she had nothing against the ROTC specifically. When she said she was going to call 911 every time, she didn't mean she would call if she knew it was the ROTC. What she really meant was that she would call if she, you know, saw people on campus who had what they should look like guns. So she backed off some of that. In response specifically to the resolution passed by the students, you know, she told, I'm reading here, I quote from the Grand Forks Herald, she said Thursday she doesn't plan to do anything because she already privately apologized to Carol for her word choice and doesn't think it's appropriate to apologize to ROTC cadets for words exchanged with him. She also hasn't been approached by any ROT students about the controversy. And you got to kind of wonder, I mean, would an ROTC student feel comfortable, you know, I guess approaching a professor who has expressed these sorts of attitudes?
I would think not, and I would not be surprised, actually, if the head of the ROTC program told these cadets, don't. You know, it's not your place, no matter what you might think and your opinion might be, don't escalate this. But I think it would be appropriate for the professor to say, hey, you know what, I'm sorry, I overreacted. Shouldn't take it out on you. Thank you for what you're doing.
I think any time in a professional environment, and, you know, obviously Lieutenant Colonel Carroll is somebody who works on campus with the ROTC program, so they're colleagues. And I think even if you have a fundamental disagreement on policy or what have you, calling up a colleague and cursing them out is something that requires an apology. And when you do it in such a public manner, yeah, you ought to apologize probably to the greater campus community as well. And who knows? Maybe she needs some sensitivity training, too, to be a little bit more tolerant of ROTC kids on campus.
Is this considered? I think this is a macroaggression, is it not? I mean, this is kind of above microaggression here. I think so, but I'm not a chancellor. So I do have to ask, Rob, I mean, is this sort of is this unusual for the University of North Dakota? To see an incident like this? Is North fairly a fairly quiet campus usually?
You know, it really is a fairly quiet campus. And I think obviously when you've got a unanimous vote from the student government, 17-0, you know, calling this professor out on her behavior, I think that's a pretty good indication. It is an outlier for behavior at the University of North Dakota. I think generally it's a pretty quiet campus, which frankly is probably why this got so much attention. You know, this isn't Berkeley we're talking about. You know, that sort of behavior is pretty unusual.
I suppose that's one silver lining. Rob, listen, thanks for coming on the program, sir. It's good talking with you. Hope we can do it again.
Yeah, certainly. Thank you.
You bet. Rob Poore joined us from Say Anything blog up there in North Dakota. Now, we were talking about this piece of the LA Times by a couple of professors at UC Irvine, Howard Gilman, who's chancellor at UC Irvine, also professor of law, political science, and history, Erwin Chemerinsky, founding dean and a professor of the UC Irvine School of Law, giving this a freshman a course on free speech, a freshman seminar on the freedom of speech, and they're a little freaked out by the freshmen that they have been dealing with. They say young people's support for freedom of speech has waned in part because of their admirable desire to create an educational environment where all can thrive. Our students or their friends have experienced the psychological harms of hateful speech or bullying more than they have experienced the social harms of censorship or the punishment of dissent. Which is kind of interesting to acknowledge that yeah, because we have lived in a society with a great deal of toleration of speech until fairly recently. So it is true, these college students probably have had to deal with their feelings being hurt more than they've had to deal with their thoughts being silenced. However, still didn't make it okay. The professors say simply telling students to toughen up isn't persuasive. Okay. Now, that doesn't mean it's not good advice, and it doesn't mean that you couldn't come up with a persuasive argument. Moreover, he says, they were born long after the civil rights movement and the anti-Vietnam War protests that gave their elders direct experience with the need for free expression. It is their education that's lacking. History, they write, demonstrates that when we give officials broad powers to restrict or punish speech considered hateful, offensive, or demeaning, that power is inevitably abused. Unpopular speakers are victimized. Legitimate opinion is silenced. Over the course of U.S. history, officials censored or punished those whose speech they disliked. Abolitionists, labor activists, religious minorities, communists and socialists, cultural critics, gays and lesbians, demonstrators and protesters of all stripes. The professors say the students were surprised to learn that people went to prison for speech criticizing the draft during World War I, or for teaching or espousing communism during the 1920s and 30s and in the McCarthy era. It wasn't really that they were just teaching or espousing communism, by the way. It's more the other things that went along with espousing communism, like, you know, pledging fealty to the communist movement, which was directed by the Soviet Union and was intent on bringing down the United States. But anyway, I digress. The effect of the First Amendment strong protections, they write, for dangerous and offensive speech allowed oppressed and marginalized groups to challenge indecency laws, segregation, patriarchy, and declarations of war. Yeah, but now people's feelings are being hurt. So, gotta go back in the other direction, apparently. Stick around. Hour 3 of NRA News, Cam and Company. Sponsored by Nozzles, coming up right after this. Hero of the day, deal of the day, good guy and more. We'll be right back after this quick time.
I'm speaking with Michael Faw of Crimson Trace. Michael, how are you, sir?
Good, John. How are you today?
I am doing great. Thanks for being back here on NRA News. All right, so ran into you here. You've got a really cool new product to show us. Tell folks, what is Crimson Trace? What do you guys do?
Crimson Trace is a laser siding manufacturer out in the Portland, Oregon area. We make more than 200 laser siding systems for firearms. We also make military siding hardware.
How does Crimson Trace, give us a quick story of how Crimson Trace came about as a company.
Came up with an idea from our founder, Lou Danielson, and then that was more than 20 years ago. We've been in business that long, and the product lines have evolved since then. So it was a concept he had, and he just grew it into what today is known as Crimson Trace, the
right.
Great American story.
And I'll tell you what did you mention before we went on the air? What, over 200 product lines?
Over 200 products. We have red and green laser siding systems now.
It's awesome. And I'll tell you what, Michael, when you talk to people in the industry, in shooting sports competitive, no matter what, it's one of those names, Crimson Trace is, you know, everyone knows about it. You talk about having a strong brand.
One of the reasons we have so many products, we listen to customers. We know that a lot of NRA members are our customers, and we listen to what customers ask for or suggestions, and that's where the product base grows from.
And you also mentioned something about NRA members.
Yes. All of our employees are also NRA members. We pay the membership for the ones who don't join on their own, but we're all 100% NRA.
And it's so awesome, Michael, when a manufacturer understands that we're all in this fight together.
And they enjoy also getting the magazines and their hats.
I love it. Speaking with Michael Faw, and he's the public and media relations manager for Crimson Trace. All right, so show us what you got, my friend. What is this?
Okay, this year we're known also for innovation. We've come up with a wireless system. The module is activated by the grip. So you can take your standard AR rifle grip off, and as long as your gun also has a rail somewhere on it, you can attach the module. So this grip is paired with that sight. So it's a laser and a light. So you can activate it this, and it's... There's more than 256 different signatures and codes that those two pieces of equipment communicate with, so there's no hacking it or no problems or anything else. So it's a wireless system designed by Crimson Trace.
Laser and a light and a wireless system, pretty cool stuff. So tell folks, what's the advantage of having a system like this?
It leaves your you've got one hand that's control of your firearm. You've got the other hand that's free. You don't have to keep reaching up. You don't have to worry about wires. You don't have to worry about cables or anything else that's getting snagged on anything if you're moving through either the brush or a building or anything. So we know that this has hunting applications for
right.
People who are pursuing pigs and coyotes. And then it also has home defense applications. And we are growing the number of modules and the options that will be available, but it will all be controlled by the grip, the pistol grip.
It has applications here with the NRA News Crew. As soon as you broke it out, we're showing to everyone, just about everybody here wants to get one.
Folks are lined up at the booth also looking at it. And yesterday at the range, we had an event, and people were lined up and just, you know, let me see this. We've heard all about it.
Let me see it. Let me have one.
Yeah, let me have one is the big request.
Michael Fall with Crimson Trace. How can folks get more information about Crimson Trace?
Obviously, crimsontrace.com. is the fastest way to get information. And then we also have more than 2,500 dealers across the U.S. So most gun ranges and gun shops sell our products. They can go in there and look at a catalog, or they can call 800-442-2406 and request a catalog. We'll send a free one. The website's also a store. They can buy stuff there. We know that all dealers don't necessarily stock all right. 200 products.
Michael, thank you so much for what you do, and thanks for being on NRA News.
Hey, John, thanks for having me.
Welcome back. Hour three of NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, starts right now. On the program this hour, Rob Pincus with Personal Defense Network on senior citizens and self-defense. Kurt Schlichter, author, columnist, high-powered California attorney, joining us later on in the hour as well. Hero of the Day, sponsored by Adcor Defense. Deal of the Day, good guy coming up in just a moment. But mentioned last hour, a bit of breaking news out of Richmond, Virginia. The Richmond Times-Dispatch reporting, two Virginia State troopers, one female civilian, have been transported to VCU Medical Center in Richmond after a shooting at the Greyhound station there on the boulevard in Richmond, Virginia. The shooting suspect, there were early reports the shooting suspect was killed. The Richmond Times-Dispatch, quoting Corrine Geller with the Virginia State Police, saying that the shooting suspect is in custody. Two workers doing landscaping work at the Diamond, which is the home of the Richmond Flying Squirrels, said that they saw a man running across the street from the bus station and then screaming something. They say next, a state police trooper pulled up to the scene and then, quote, chaos erupted and people started streaming out of the Greyhound building. 28-year-old Brendan Hamilton, who's visiting Richmond from Baltimore, said he was about to walk into the Greyhound bus station about 2:50 in the afternoon when he heard two loud bangs and then started seeing flashes of light along with about 5 to 10 more banging noises. People began running out of nearly all of the doors of the building, Hamilton said. At this point, he said it became clear to him that shots were being fired, and he sprinted from the scene. So we still don't have a lot of news or information about what exactly took place here. But we do know that there were two police officers taken to VCU Medical Center, a female civilian as well, and the Virginia State Police say that the suspect there is in custody at this time. So we will continue to follow that news and try to give you more details as they become available. In the meantime, let's get to our hero of the day, sponsored by Adcor Defense. Today's story from WTOC Channel 11 down there in Savannah, Georgia. It was on the south side of Savannah. Officers responded to shots fired at a mobile home community about 5:45 Wednesday morning. Lamb Blake lives there on Grove Point Road. He says he woke up to two people breaking into his home. They were claiming to be police. And Mr. Blake says that he could see them on surveillance video, and he knew that they were not police officers. He says that he keeps two firearms there in his home, and when the two suspects broke in, he was ready. He said the suspects fired at him in return. He fired back. The suspects then ran from the home. Lamb Blake wasn't injured. And he says, quote, this gun saved my life. Without this gun, I might not be here right now. Lamb Blake is a handicapped veteran, according to WTOC. He says, when I saw them coming in, like I said, he said, I was waiting for them. And standing there with his weapons drawn, scared the suspects away. He says they cowardly ran off and fired shots to my house. He says when the suspect shot at him, he returned fire. He says, my gun saved my life. Yes, it did. Now, WTOC says Metro Police say that they take this type of crime very seriously. In addition, to attempted robbery charges. The suspects could face a felony for impersonating a police officer. And officers are advising citizens that if someone says they are the police and you do not believe them, trust your instincts and call 911 immediately. The officer quoted there by WTOC, don't have a name, but said, quote, this is Savannah, Georgia, and we do have one of the highest rates of crime in the world. So to us in Savannah, it's just routine. You've just got to be prepared. He also had advice for anybody committing crime in the area. He said there are citizens out here who are legally carrying firearms, and criminals, be aware. Well, Lam Blake, a veteran of our military and a armed citizen now, able to defend himself from those armed intruders in Savannah, Georgia, today's hero of the day. Our deal of the day, a little bit different than the types of deals that we normally cover. Usually these are a lot of robberies, rap sheets as long as your arm for violent crimes. This one, like I said, a little bit different. Channel 12, KSLA in Louisiana, Denham Springs, Louisiana. Jeffrey Blau, he's 51 years of age. He is currently in the East Baton Rouge Parish Prison after being arrested and charged with a DUI last Sunday. KSLA says it not the first time that Mr. Blau has been arrested for drinking and then getting behind the wheel of a vehicle. District Attorney Hilar Moore says, obviously, this gentleman is battling and having some issues. He's apparently, from what I read, indicated that he had problems and was attempting to deal with those problems. Uh-huh. So the most recent batch of problems for Mr. Blau started last Saturday. A small crash, KSLA says, in the parking lot of a Denham Springs motel. A Denham Springs police officer arrested Mr. Blau, charged him with DUI. First offense, it was not, by the way, his first offense. A low bond allowed Blau to get out of jail and then cause another crash just hours later on Interstate 12. Happened near the Millerville exit, injuring two people. But KSLA says the question remains how someone who has been arrested for DUI more than 10 times is able to be behind the wheel of a car. Yep. More than a dozen DUI arrests dating back to 1983. For the 51-year-old man. Major Doug Kane with the Louisiana State Police said whoever made the arrest in Denham Springs should have noticed it in the state criminal history database called LATCH. He says in 2014 they passed Act 299, which mandates that every DUI be fingerprinted out of jail and put in the AFIS, the Automated Fingerprint Identification System, before that summons is cut. So now we have a good track record of what arrest took place and when. And he says, with the amount of red flags, someone in the police department there should have pinned Blau to this lengthy criminal history. He said every one of Blau's arrests are in the system. The Denham Springs Police Department is citing human error as the reason why Blau was able to slip through the cracks. They released a statement that read, the department wants to take every measure possible to find out why this happened and then take action to where it never happens again. Interestingly enough, by the way, they report that the chief of police there in Denham Springs has been on paid leave for about 6 weeks, pending the outcome of an unrelated internal investigation there. Here's the thing. It may have been human error here that allowed Mr. Blau to get off with a low bail and then get back out on the street and behind the wheel of a vehicle. But 1983, twice in 1984, once in 1990, once in 1992, once in 1993, once in 1994, twice in 1998, once in 2004, once in 2009, twice in 2016. Man, those were a lot of arrests for the same crime here. And again, this is the way the system is set up for someone like Jeffrey Blau. Hey, do you think, Cameron, we're going to hear about the need to make it harder for people like Mr. Blau to get behind the wheel of a car? Like, do we need vehicle control? Do we need to maybe post his picture up at car dealerships in the area so that Mr. Blau can't get behind the wheel?
No. No. I don't see that coming. Not in the slightest.
I don't either. Yeah. Unfortunately not. Jeffrey Blau of Denham Springs, Louisiana. Guy who definitely could use some help and doesn't need a drink. Our deal of the day today. Our good guy from the Columbia Daily Herald in Tennessee, story of a Tennessee highway patrolman, you know the drill, in the right place at the right time and was able to do the right thing. Not just able to, but willing to do the right thing. Jay Powell reporting, it was on U.S. Highway 43 in Columbia, Tennessee. Trooper Zach Newton was on his way to start a shift. He came across a wreck involving two cars about 3:30 in the afternoon. So he stopped because that's what he does. When he arrived at the scene, he noticed members of the first vehicle were standing outside. They appeared uninjured. While speaking with the driver, he was told that the black sedan located approximately 200 yards ahead was on fire and that the driver was still trapped inside. Zach Newton says, I didn't have time to be nervous. I didn't have time to be scared. When he got there to the car, he noticed that there was a woman trapped inside. All the doors of the vehicle were jammed. He said it was possibly due to an auto lock feature that had been, you know, triggered after the car was put in drive. The car, again, is on fire at this point. And Trooper Newton can't get into the vehicle through one of the doors. So he takes out his baton. He said he smashed the rear window, was able to pull the woman out of the car. He said the car became engulfed seconds after he pulled her to safety. He said, I told her, bundle up in the jacket. I busted the glass. I had her come to me, and I got her out. Shortly thereafter, the car went up in flames. Driver of the car complained of chest pain. She was transported to a local hospital. She was released, thankfully, later that evening. The Tennessee Highway Patrol recognized Zach Newton with a press conference yesterday at the Columbia Driver Services Center. Trooper Newton said he doesn't want to be considered a hero, that he was just doing his job, and he acted on behalf of his training and his duties as an officer sworn to protect. He said it feels good, especially with everything going on in the world. Law enforcement needs something positive, so it's good to be appreciated, he says. I don't consider myself a hero, but was just in the right place at the right time. They always say that. But there's that one extra element. Because, again, there were a lot of people who probably drove by that wreck, maybe wanted to help, thought about helping, figured somebody else was on their way to help. Maybe they pick up the phone, they call 911. But Zach Newton stopped. He also, by the way, stressed the importance of wearing a seatbelt. He said had the driver not been wearing hers, she might have received far worse injuries or possibly died. He said the fire probably would have been the least of her worries had she not been wearing a seatbelt. She took care of the first part. We took care of the second part. Well, I'm glad that she's all right. I'm glad the others in that wreck are uninjured, and I'm glad that Trooper Zach Powell down there in the great state of Tennessee was around to help save a life. Thank you, sir, for being one of the many, many good guys out there. Now, Rob Pincus is going to join us on the program of the Personal Defense Network here in a couple minutes, talking about that piece at Gawker. Just awful, awful. I see this stuff and I really think to myself, do I even want to mention it? Do I even want to give it the oxygen? Or do I just want to ignore stuff like this? Most of the time you can ignore it. But this was just, I'm pretty sure it was written intentionally to be trolling. But it's also just wrong. I'm used to reading the stuff that's just clickbaity. But this was just flat out wrong. Hamilton Nolan. When you're old, you're slow as hell. And decades of muscle erosion have made you weak. Pretty much any healthy young person can beat you up. Is a gun going to even things out? Nope, Hamilton Nolan writes. In order for that gun to work, you have to pull it out and aim it in a moment of crisis. And while you're fumbling to do that all slow, a young person is just pushing you on the ground and taking your gun out of your feeble hands. Your reflexes are faded as hell, he writes. You might as well just learn to get along with people. Who do you think you are, Charles Bronson? More like Charles Osgood. Stop acting crazy, he says. So, before we take a break, a couple of extra armed citizen stories for you. From not too long ago. And I apologize. I could have found more. I just looked for a couple of minutes here. From the Indianapolis Star, September of 2015. A 76-year-old man shot a robbery suspect, injuring him inside his East Side home early Monday evening. Again, this was back on the 22nd of September. Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department officers dispatched to the 700 block of North Bossart Avenue around 4:45 on a report of a person shot. When officers arrived at the location, they found a man, later identified as 27-year-old Anthony Talley, suffering from several gunshot wounds. Early reports from police indicated that a woman shot Talley, but in a statement released by the department Monday night, police said it was the woman's husband that had fired his weapon. Police said that Talley was attempting to rob the 75-year-old woman inside of her rental office. When the suspect pointed a gun at the woman, her husband, who Talley didn't see, appeared from the back of the home. Fearing for his wife's safety, he pulled out a handgun and critically injured Talley with multiple gunshot wounds. The 76-year-old man defending his 75-year-old wife. Then you have a story from earlier this year in Londonderry, New Hampshire. The Londonderry Patch, headline, cops, granny got her gun. I hate that headline. Don't mind the stories, but I hate the headline. Anyway, they had the a story of a 65-year-old woman, concealed carry holder, who was attacked by a 23-year-old man. Woman said it was about 11:30 in the evening. She stopped at a mobile in Londonderry after work. She headed back out onto the street. A dark-colored sedan behind her vehicle was following her. As the woman entered her apartment complex, she attempted to find a vacant spot near her building, and the sedan parked near her vehicle. She left her car, headed to her apartment. She, according to the Manchester Police Department, immediately heard a vehicle door close and a person quickly walking up behind her. She looked and observed a white male with a dark hooded sweatshirt quickly approach her, run past her, and immediately block her path. The male then reached out and attempted to grab her. The woman withdrew her handgun and shot the man in the chest at close range, then ran inside her apartment and called 911. The police spokesman, Lieutenant Brian O'Keefe of the Manchester Police Department, said the victim, who is described as 4 feet 11 inches tall and 105 pounds, was in fear for her safety. The victim, who has a valid concealed carry permit, fired one round to stop the attack before seeking a safe zone inside of the building. Her attacker, 5 feet 11, 200 pounds, 23 years of age, at the age of 23, already had previous criminal actions involving criminal threatening, reckless conduct, as well as driving and drug charges. He was charged with felony robbery and arraigned at the hospital, due back in court in January. I have to see if we can find an update for that story. But no, Hamilton Nolan is wrong. He's really, really wrong. The premise for this piece was this Wall Street Journal story about more senior citizens who are owning guns, and apparently Hamilton hates this idea. Because, again, old people, according to Hamilton, are feeble and frail, and their reflexes are too slow, and they're just going to have that gun taken from them, and they're just going to be beaten up. It's just going to end up worse. You just need to learn, he says, to get along with people, including those who would break into your home. View you as a easy mark and may not be interested in getting along with you at all, unfortunately. Again, we'll talk about this this attitude and the reality of self-defense for even senior citizens coming up after a quick timeout. So stick around. There is much more. NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, right after this.
All right, so we're out walking around here, and I ran into Glenn Klecker with Klecker Knives. All right, tell me, what is Klecker Knives? What are you all about?
Klecker Knives is basically about innovation, family values, good old whatever I can do to help people enjoy their time in the outdoors and bring their family doing it.
All right, and you got some really neat stuff, so show us some of your products here.
Well, the first one I want to show here is the trigger. This is basically like a knife kit. We designed a wooden one that we released before with my son Nathan.
Mm-hmm.
This is the follow-on version. The idea behind this is it's a bunch of parts you can build together like a model car or model plane.
Cool.
You put the pieces together and it's a full locking knife, but it's not sharp. It's guaranteed to cut butter though.
That's cool. What else you got?
So then the next one is, this is the Cordovan. This is our most popular folding knife. And the idea behind the Cordovan is that it has a locking system that I have a patent on. So this is called the Klecker Lock. Then over here we have a new one for this year is called the Abiquois. Comes built with a Kydex sheath. The idea behind the Abiquois is that people want really good, comfortable hunting knife. Fits good in the hand. But the benefit of the Abiquois is that it has a built-in gut hook right into the handle.
Oh, nice.
So it gives you a nice full three-finger gut hook, so you're not going to lose it. So this is called the Klax. It stands for the Klecker Axe System. The idea behind this is how can you go to the woods, have the tools you need, and not have to carry all the bulk that you would normally.
Okay.
So on a regular axe, you're going to carry around an axe that's got a handle. It's about this size.
Right.
But with this, you carry around just this. When you need to, you can take this, use it as a hand tool, carve yourself a handle, cut a split in it, and then just flip the clamps out, slide it down over the handle, tighten it up, whack it on the log a few times, seat the clamps, and then you can start going to town.
Awesome. How can folks get more information about Klecker Knives?
So you can find us on the web at kleckerknives.com.
All right. Glenn Klecker with Klecker Knives. Save the best for last. Dennis, one. This is one for you for Dennis's auto. There you go, buddy. Thanks for being on NRA News. We appreciate it.
All right. Thanks a lot.
You're an American. That means you're free to defend your life. But Carol Bowne is no longer with us because the state of New Jersey denied her that right. When her convicted felon ex-boyfriend smashed her car windows, she got a restraining order. Despite having home security cameras and an alarm system, she feared for her life. So she applied for a handgun permit. More than a month later, and just 2 days before her death, she demanded an update. Her application was still processing. Carol Bowne didn't choose to be utterly defenseless when her predator stabbed her to death in her driveway 2 days later. That choice was made by the state of New Jersey. Government policies that deny us our right to defend our lives are not just ineffective, they are immoral. If you refuse to surrender your life to the dictates of your government, speak out. You can make a difference. The 5 million men and women of the National Rifle Association of America fight for you. We are freedom's safest place.
We don't rise up to the occasion, but instead fall back on our level of training. Champions spend hours practicing for the smallest improvements. In order not to be a victim, it's important that you have a plan.
That's the perfect time to take your shot.
I am Gabby Franco, and I'll see you next time in another episode of Tips and Tactics, sponsored by Cabela's Outdoor Fund.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company. All right, those of you sitting down for dinner at Denny's at 4:20 in the afternoon here on NRA News, Cam and Company, enjoy this segment. I know, so awful, right? Rob Pincus of Personal Defense Network is with us on the program. How you doing, Rob?
Great, man. How you doing?
I am excellent. I appreciate you coming on the program. And look, as somebody who frankly, plans on being and hopes to be a senior citizen one day. I don't plan on giving up my human right of self-defense anytime soon. So I am kind of personally invested in this story. But, you know, more broadly, I thought that this piece at Gawker, it's awful. I mean, it's Gawker. But it's just flat out wrong
Rob, for this guy, Hamilton Nolan, who frankly doesn't think that anybody should own a gun, to try to tell senior citizens, you're old, you're frail, your decades of muscle erosion have made you weak. Any healthy young person can beat you up while you're fumbling with your gun all slow. A young person is just pushing you to the ground, taking your gun out of your feeble hands. Old people, he says, don't own a gun. What's your response, Rob?
You know, it honestly, when I looked at it this morning, that article, it was so offensive, so ridiculous, that my first inclination was to just dismiss it and not give it any thought. It's
right.
Stalker, it's ridiculous. But this is an important conversation, and it's not necessarily that I think someone who listens to NRA News, listens to Cam & Co, listens to Personal Defense Network, listens to me is going to say, oh, I'm going to change my mind now because this guy at Gawker said I don't deserve to have the right to meet the responsibility for personal defense because I'm of advanced age. I think it's ridiculous. But what is important is part of the conversation that people that maybe aren't in that demographic understand is, guess what? Whether you are really, really strong or really, really weak, those words don't mean much. They're relative words. They're comparison words. They're subjective words. What we stress on the range, what we stress with anybody, I don't care if you think you're generally weak in upper body strength. I don't care if you think you're generally frail, or if you think you are genuinely strong or generally big and tough and have a high level of dexterity or a low level of dexterity. None of these things matter. These are all subjective issues. When you come to the realization that you're responsible for your personal defense and you want to integrate a firearm into that defensive plan that you have, of course you have to take your own strengths and weaknesses into account. And if you're less agile than you used to be, less athletic, less strong than you used to be, you have to train for today. If someone gets injured, they have to train for today. If someone gets a disease, has a neuromuscular disorder, they have to train for today. And that doesn't change when you're 50, when you're 60, when you're 70. People get targeted more often when the perception is that they aren't going to be able to defend themselves. There are a lot of older people who turn to defensive training for the first time in their lives when they reach the, you know, quote unquote senior citizen or quote unquote elderly or quote unquote advanced age, whatever you want to call it. There are people who feel like, you know what, I can handle myself at 30. I can handle myself at 40. I can handle myself at, well, maybe not 55, maybe not 60, maybe not 65. I'm going to get that equalizer. I'm going to get the training. I'm going to get the efficient firearm that I learn how to use, that I understand when I can use it, and they train to use it appropriately. And I think that's incredibly important, and we shouldn't underestimate that. What this guy just did was he bought into the same mentality that causes the street punk, the petty criminal, the person looking for the easy target to target the elderly people, is they assume, oh, these guys can't do anything because they're over the age of 60, and it's just not true.
Talking to you with Rob Pickens of the Personal Defense Network, and you know, Rob, this whole Gawker piece was prompted by an article at the Wall Street Journal talking about the growing number of senior citizens who are becoming gun owners. And certainly this is something that we've seen when we've talked with firearms instructors around the country. I mean, they are seeing more women, but they are also seeing, frankly, they're seeing more people. So they are seeing more senior citizens. They're also seeing more people in their 20s and their 30s and their 40s. They're seeing more men. They're seeing more women because they're seeing more people who are deciding that that this is something that they want to do. I'm curious, are you seeing that with the students who are showing up for your courses?
I am. I'll say overall, the average age of students has probably gone down in general because it used to be, you know, 10, 15 years ago, the person that came out to the shooting course was almost always a lifelong shooter, someone who had been around guns, somebody who had some experience and, you know, had reached that point in life where they had a little more free time, a little more free money. And in the 90s, that was the person in their 40s, 50s, or 60s you'd see in the classes more often than not, if it wasn't an armed professional, it was an open enrollment type defensive shooting class. And quite frankly, a lot of the destination places, including Valhalla, when I was running Valhalla, sort of catered to that half hobbyist, half enthusiast, you know, person who took training seriously, but maybe would go to a class a year. And most of those people were going to be older people. What we've seen in the last couple decades with the growth of CCW, with the growth of understanding the Second Amendment as not a piece of heritage or tradition, but a really important piece of personal defense and national defense, we've seen more and more younger people come out. But what's interesting to me is the demographic that's interesting is more and more older people who are first-time gun owners or first-time shooters or coming to their first class. So it would have been very rare 15 or 20 years ago to see someone in their 50s coming to a defensive shooting class, and it was their first one, or maybe they were there with their first firearm they ever owned and they purchased it recently. We're seeing that more and more often. We know if we look at the demographics across the country that that baby boomer generation, there's a lot of people in the retiree category who are coming to the realization that the firearm, with appropriate training, of course, the appropriate firearm, one that is efficient, one that is easy to use, one that doesn't have a lot of extra levers and buttons on it, one that's, a 9mm type firearm, maybe a .380, something where the recoil management doesn't demand an undue amount of strength or coordination. They're coming to the realization that this type of tool is exactly what they need in their lives to feel like they can meet the challenges that may be put upon them by someone who thinks, oh, there's an older person, I'll bet they're going to be an easy target, and we need to be able to prove them wrong. And those people obviously need to be able to prove them wrong. And sometimes it's the tool and the training that will do that. You know, I was in Alabama a couple days ago. I'm out on the Personal Defense Network training tour. We always start in Florida. I go up into Alabama, and I'm at a shopping mall, and I've got the Ekka Dog, the training tour mascot, with me this year. So I pull into kind of the back area of the mall, and I let her out of the truck. Truck's got all the PDN logos, all the sponsor logos on it. Walking the dog, and definitely an older gentleman, white-haired gentleman, comes moving towards me at a relatively fast and clearly targeted pace. If this guy had been 40 years younger wearing a hoodie and had been bark out, it would have definitely been an alarm moment of why is this guy coming towards me so excited and so determined. He was coming towards me to tell me that he had just become a PDN premium member, that he's an NRA lifetime member, that he values the information we put out, and that, you know, a lot of people think he was a Vietnam vet, it turns out. A lot of people look at him and think, oh, that guy's a pushover, that guy's a victim. But he's determined not to be that, and that's why he's seeking out training and information and seeking out the kind of information he gets from the NRA, from Personal Defense Network. And he just recognized the logos on the truck and wanted to tell me all about it. And I love that. I love that as much as a female who's the first-time shooter, first-time gun buyer that comes up to me, or the 20-something that comes up to me, the people that are outside of that, you know, middle-aged white guy demographic that so many people want to push on our community as a cliche. Our community is a lot more diverse than that, and older people who take their training and their firearms seriously and are very capable with them, by the way, are a big part of that.
I mean, absolutely. I mean, what you're talking about, I think, is so important, is that, you know, it's the mindset, and whether you're, you know, 18 or 80, the mindset is the most important thing, because if you don't have that, you have nothing really to build on from there, right?
Yeah, you have to have the determination. You have to have not false confidence. You don't just buy a gun and stick it in your purse or stick it, inside a holster and wear it and say, oh, I'm ready now, I'll be okay. You have to get the training. And that's the problem. This article insinuates that the training won't help, that there's some physical limitation just because you've reached a certain age that says, oh, it doesn't matter that you have this tool. It doesn't matter that you might have the mindset and take this training seriously. You're not capable. Stop fooling yourself. And, you know, this article, you could have written this about women. You could have written this about people who live in the inner city and didn't grow up with guns. You could take these same ridiculous, offensive cliches and myths and throw them at any demographic you want, and it's still just as inaccurate. The truth is, any human being with any reasonably efficient firearm that fits them well can learn to use that firearm within a context, right? Where there are going to be situations where if I'm at the mall and, you know, I've done a fair amount of training, I've carried guns for a while, I've been on some ranges, I've had some training, I've done some shooting, I've done some practicing. If I'm at the mall and I'm with my family and 100 yards away from me down the aisle across the food court, an active shooter spree killer pulls out a gun and starts shooting people, and there's 400 people between me and him, I'm not going to pull out my 4-inch defensive carry, concealed carry pistol and, you know, take shots at this guy's head. There's a context where the gun isn't going to do me any good, and I'm going to realize that, and I'm going to make other choices to keep myself safe or get my family out of there. But there are other situations where a firearm definitely would suit me well, given my ability to use it, my comfort and my confidence because of training and because of practice. And somebody stronger, somebody weaker, somebody smaller, somebody bigger is going to find those same limitations and those same conditions under which the firearm is the appropriate tool. So I think to say, oh, you're older, or oh, you're weaker, or oh, you're not as experienced, so don't get a gun, is buying into the myth. You can take a class, you can get an efficient gun, and relatively quickly, relatively efficiently develop a baseline of skills where you can defend yourself in the overwhelming majority of defensive situations that have required firearms in the past. We can just look at it and say, okay, that's what we need to prepare for. Guess what? 99.9% of the human population can be prepared for that with a legally owned efficient firearm.
There you go. Rob, listen, I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. All right, you're out on tour right now. What's the best way for folks to find out where you might be coming next?
Not just me, but also we have 10 instructors on the PDN tour this year. So personaldefensenetwork.com. Click on the training tab. They're going to see a complete list of courses. There's still 3.5 months left on the tour. Lots of courses, lots of topics, lots of great instructors. I've got about, I don't know, probably 30, 40 more classes left on the tour. And, of course, when they're at PDN, they can see all the great free videos, free articles from our entire contributor team at personaldefensenetwork.com.
Awesome, man. Thanks so much for coming on the program. It's a pleasure talking with you again.
Great to be here. Thanks, man.
We'll talk to you soon. Rob Pincus joining us from Personal Defense Network here on NRA News, Cam and Company. Mr. Kurt Schlichter will join us on the program in just a couple of minutes as well. Now, I do have some other legislative news to talk about before we take a break. Out in Colorado, legislation to repeal the state's magazine ban passed out of the State Senate Veterans and Military Affairs Committee by a vote of 3-2 yesterday. It is Senate Bill 113, now heads to the Senate floor for consideration by the full Senate. You can contact your state senator now in Colorado. Also in Hawaii, a number of anti-gun bills introduced this session. One of them yesterday was deferred. Any action was deferred on it, but three others actually passed out of committee. So let's talk about the three that are on the move right now. House Bill 625 would expand prohibited possessors to include a certain misdemeanor crimes. Under this bill, NRA Eiley reports sending unwanted text messages and emails could qualify somebody for misdemeanor stalking and could possibly result in an individual being denied a constitutional right. House Bill 2629 would expand the existing registration requirement and input law-abiding Hawaii gun owners into a federal biometric database managed by the FBI for continuous monitoring. Because you are a gun owner, you get to be put in that database. Also, House Bill 2632 would expand the list of possible prohibited possessors to include anyone who has undergone or is undergoing emergency hospitalization. This is about as specific as the language gets, apparently. It could involve somebody who suffered something as common as diabetic shock to suddenly lose their Second Amendment rights without due process of law simply for receiving care. You would be, under the terms of this law, required to surrender your firearms immediately, or else law enforcement would seize those firearms without due process. And then the bill that was deferred yesterday, Senate Bill, there was one more bill actually that advanced out of committee, Senate Bill 2647. It's one of the ivory bills that the ostensible purpose is to protect elephants and rhinos in Africa by making it harder to import ivory products illegally, hopefully cut down on poaching. The problem with this is that the bill itself goes after people who aren't engaged in illegal activity. And this would involve everything from, you know, ivory on historic firearms to ivory on pianos to ivory in other musical instruments. You've actually seen a lot of opposition from people beyond hunters to these measures when they've been introduced to the state level. And Hawaii is far from the only state that has seen this measure. And you've got people, listen, you've got people who are animal lovers. You've got people who are conservationists. You've got people who absolutely despise hunting, who still are opposed to this because... It's aimed in the wrong direction. This isn't aimed at poachers. This is not aimed at the people who are illegally importing ivory. This is aimed at people who own and possess items right now. It can't necessarily provide documentation as to when these items were created, who all of a sudden may be told that you can't sell this item anymore. It would be illegal for you to do so. Again, it would ban the sale, purchase, barter, and possession with intent to sell any ivory product, rhinoceros horn product, or products from various other animal species. So antique dealers, collectors, people who own antiques, you're kind of out of luck there. The poachers themselves, not really impacted by this. So again, that bill advancing in the state of Hawaii as well. All right, when we return here on this edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, our friend Kurt Schlichter joins us on the program. So much to talk with Kurt about, including what's going on our college campuses. Stick around. There's more. NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, right after this. Well, listen, I appreciate both of you coming on the program. It is a real pleasure to see each of you in person here. What is it, Nick, that got you so interested in the United States? Was there a moment when you realized, like, all right, I'm beyond simply unhappy with the way things are going in Australia?
Well, look, I think my very first word, Cam, was Coca-Cola. So that was probably a sign of things to
both
come.
Both of them, or just one?
Yeah, that's right. But look, I all my life, since a young boy, I was drawn to the United States. And I know it's something that's very difficult to explain, but it's not just me. There's lots of people like Charles and I put you in this same category, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Elon Musk.
I'm quite like him as well.
Stuart Varney, yes. Yeah. And
often in the same category, Charles.
Yeah. But just for the muscles.
Right, of course.
Just muscles.
Well, the accent, again,
yeah, well,
he's
got
accent.
Another good accent. Yeah. Now the Twitter feed's really going to blow
right.
up. But look, there is definitely something about the optimism, the vibrancy, the individualism, the existence, I think, of a still very strong faith in America that really makes it the place to be. I mean, this, Cam, is the place where magic happens. This is the country, I think, where initiative, risk, and confidence go further than anywhere else. And it's why, contrary to what you hear in the media, contrary to what the elite will preach, it's why more people want to come to America than want to go anywhere else.
So despite what the president says, maybe there's something, there is something real about the idea of American exceptionalism. Not that the people are better, but that the place is better. The place is unique. The place is something different. Yeah.
Well, it is culture. I mean, it's not in the water,
right.
I think. It's not as if any constitution had been passed, America would have been to the moon in 1969. It's not foreordained, and I think that's the interesting point, that you have a constitutional order here that is built upon principles that are, at least initially, British, and played out in Australia to an extent, but have been lost and eroded. And America has not lost them yet, although many are trying. In a sense, you have here a far more intact and uncorrupted form of classical liberalism, which we call conservatism here, or libertarianism.
Or conservatarianism, perhaps.
Or conservatarianism, or available at all good bookstores. And that is extremely attractive if you believe in those things, but like Nick and myself, grew up in a country that had largely lost those values.
All right, so we've got running for the Democratic nomination a guy who calls himself a Democratic Socialist. Mm. And, you know, there's been a lot of conversation about what that means. And I've engaged briefly with some Sanders supporters, and they keep bringing up, like, Norway or, you know, Scandinavian countries. We don't want to be like Russia. We're not talking about Venezuela. We want to be like Norway. Mm. Explain to me, if America is freedom and, let's say, North Korea is totalitarianism, where is Australia? Where is Great Britain on that spectrum? What is it? Is it like, because again, you don't have knocks on the door in the middle of the night and the secret police coming to take you away. But you mentioned a lack of energy in politics. Is it innervation? Is it apathy? Is it you don't fight because you know you can't win because your rights have disappeared so long ago?
Well, I think the rights have been blunted rather than disappear completely. I mean, you can still stand up on an upturned cart on the corner, mostly, and speak. There are some exceptions, of course. In fact, we do in England arrest people if they say the wrong thing on the upturned cart. But the average person speaking is not going to be in trouble. It's just that the point at which the rights become challenging, which is really any right should be challenging by definition, it's blunted and it's dulled. Now, of course, on a scale which ranges from the United States to North Korea, Britain and Australia are both much closer to the United States.
Right.
But you hear frequently this idea, especially when it comes to, say, speech, that, well, we have to balance offense and liberty.
Well, there's no point in having the right college campuses.
Well, exactly, and that's the great fear that it will spread here as well. But I think it's the same when it comes to the Second Amendment and the idea, well, you have a right not ever to be in harm's way. Well, I'm afraid that's not how rights work.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Lovell Terrace Apartment, Kurt Schlichter will bring us back together. It's weird how that works. How you doing, Mr. Schlichter?
I am loving, and I am torn apart. So that's, love is my middle name.
I love, is it, really?
Yes.
Huh. Kurt
not
Love Schlichter. Is that kind of like World Be Free? Remember the basketball player? Remember him?
I would assume there's a basketball player named that, but you know how I am about sports ball.
Sports ball, right,
I'm sure
forgot.
He was a good kicker.
World Be Free, yes. That's the, kicker for basketball. For sports ball, you're right. I just want to, you know, did you ever see the movie Basketball, Kurt, featuring Matt Parker and Trey Stone? Maybe I got the names backwards there.
You know what? I know it
Trey
exists.
Parker, Matt Stone. You need to watch that. As a sports ball fan, I think you would like basketball. I think that might actually be your sport.
Okay. All right. Does it involve, a lot of booze and...
Yes.
Oh, good.
And
okay.
Trash talking.
Oh, well.
Which is why...
I think I've got the trash talking down.
And the movie was produced by the guy behind Airplane, Jerry Zemeckis. So,
oh, okay.
Yeah. I don't know how you missed that one, buddy. Honestly.
I don't know. I don't watch art films.
Too busy. Too busy,
you know,
at the New Warner concert.
Subtitles. The end of it says scene.
Yeah, right. So I got to ask you. There's a lot of stuff going on in California. I want to talk a little bit about what's going on college campuses around the country. But I saw a piece today. You've heard about Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom's gun control referendum that he's trying to get on the ballot, right?
Oh, yeah, he's an idiot.
Okay. So there's the Coalition for Civil Liberties, which has come together in opposition to this. It's fascinating, Kurt. I mean, you've got, obviously, gun owners. You've got, competition shooters. But you've also got the California State Sheriff's Association has come out in opposition to this gun control referendum. You've got prosecutors who are opposed to this. You just had the Western State Sheriff's Association sign on in opposition to this. And they are saying... I think incredibly salient points. I mean, they're simply pointing out that what Gavin Newsom is trying to do is going to be ineffective. It's going to be impossible to enforce from their perspective, and it's aimed at the wrong target. It's going after the law-abiding citizen as opposed to the violent crime.
Well, of course, that's who Gavin Newsom dislikes. He likes rich liberals and people who don't work. Everybody else, he just wants to screw with. And it's going to continue to decrease respect for the rule of law. It's going to, of course, trigger a bunch of litigation. And hopefully it will trigger a bunch of Californians who kind of sat out things for a long time to get in and come out and vote. So that's why Jerry Brown hasn't done this sort of thing. Because Jerry Brown understood this is a way to mobilize normal Californians again.
You know, and it's interesting you point that out because there was a piece in the Orange County Register by a assistant state prosecutor, I think in Los Angeles County, who pointed out Kevin De Leon is not supporting Gavin Newsom's gun control measures. Now, I don't think Kevin De Leon has ever met a gun control bill he didn't like. Governor Brown, who's been fairly mixed this second time around in the governor's position, is not supporting this. You're right, because... You know, look, I guess it's really easy in California. It's easier in California to put a referendum on the ballot. You all seem to be doing that almost every election now. So is that the idea that they're going to try all of these people who are going to go out and vote in favor of the gun control measures?
Nobody is going to go out to vote in favor of the gun control. People will go out to vote against it.
But Gavin Newsom, is predicated his whole campaign on this idea that he is hoping to draw people out who vote for this, and then they'll vote for him, too.
Gavin Newsom is an idiot. He is literally one of the stupidest people who has ever been. Okay? He he is the kind of guy you literally have to remind to breathe. Okay? You can say a lot of things about Jerry Brown. But he is, Jerry Brown is a smart guy and a good politician. And he saw that, A, this is a useful let's go poke at the squares law. And B, it was just going to tick off people who didn't, who weren't being active. And why do that? Gavin Newsom is a San Franciscan, and I grew up just south of San Francisco. I hate that contemptible cesspool more than any other place on earth. I detest everything about San Francisco, including the chicks who are ugly. But he came out of that. And his whole thing is to go and screw with people like you and me because it's going to make his friends giggle with glee. And what he's going to do is he's going to activate a bunch of people who weren't activated before. So you want to rock and roll, Gavin? Let's rock and roll.
Talking again with Kurt Schlichter here. Listen, I'm gonna put you in contact with the Coalition for Civil Liberties, for more civil liberties. All right.
I'm for civil liberties. Unlike Gavin, I actually did something to promote them.
There you go.
And protect them.
There you go. All right. Listen, I'm sure you've also seen the news as well. In Northern Virginia, the George Mason School of Law being renamed
Antonin Scalia. I think that's a sensational idea to rename it after Antonin Scalia. And I think it's a great idea, not simply because I subscribe to Antonin Scalia's points of view, which I do. The fact is, he is was a transcendently brilliant jurist. Whether you like what he says or not, I mean, I have liberal partners who rave about the way that Scalia thought and wrote. They don't have to agree with him.
Mm-hmm.
But as lawyers, they saw this is a guy who understands what it means to be a lawyer. And, you know, nobody dislikes lawyers more than me, Cam, as you know. But every once in a while, you know, you get a lawyer out there who's doing the right thing, like Alan Gura and many others who fought for our civil liberties, Thurgood Marshall. And there are important things that lawyers do. And Scalia epitomized that. It's absolutely appropriate that a school be named after. He's so influential on law. And this is not, and it's not just because I agree with his take. This is a guy who had a tremendous influence. You listen to oral arguments from the U.S. Supreme Court, and they are focused on the things that Scalia brought to the fore. Original intent, how does this measure up with what the founders wanted? These are questions that weren't getting asked until Scalia came in and said, look, these are questions that need to be asked. This is a way of looking at things. You don't have to agree with him. But to say he wasn't influential is ridiculous. To say he didn't epitomize what it means to be a lawyer, you know, lawyers go and buy his book on writing. It's not a book about what he thinks. It's a book on how to argue and how to think and how to talk and how to be an advocate. I mean, tremendously influential, whether you like him or not. So this is hugely appropriate.
Do you think that we will see now, again, this comes apparently, there were several donors, including Kurt, from the Charles Koch Foundation. Right, I know. But apparently there was a $10 million donation from the Charles Koch Foundation, $20 million from an anonymous donor to name the school in honor of Antonin Scalia. But, you know, beyond that, do you think that we will see a movement among attorneys to, you know, let's say, name a federal courthouse after Antonin Scalia?
That's a huge, for a guy who's so influential, I think that's absolutely appropriate. And, you know, he was more than just influential. He symbolized what, you know, the civility of law. His best friend on the court was Ruth Bader Ginsburg,
yep,
who has never issued a decision I agreed with, maybe one. Statistically, she had to sometime.
Here's actually what Justice Ginsburg had to say about the naming of the George Mason Law School after Antonin Scalia. She said, Justice Scalia was a law teacher, public servant, legal commentator, and jurist nonpareil. As a colleague who held him in highest esteem and great affection, I miss his bright company and the stimulus he provided, his opinions ever challenging me to meet his best efforts with my own. It's a tribute altogether fitting that George Mason University's law school will bear his name. May the funds for scholarships, faculty growth, and curricular development aid the Antonin Scalia School of Law to achieve the excellence characteristic of Justice Scalia, Grand Master in Life and Law.
Wow, classy.
Right?
I mean, you know, wouldn't it be nice to be back to a country where you could disagree with someone and not have them hate you? I mean, really, where you could have, you know, I disagree with your, you know, mode of legal analysis, but it's Miller time.
It would be nice to get back to that.
That would be nice, and I'm trying to do it because of, you know, I have my outspoken dislike of Trump, but I have a lot of very good friends who have found that Trump speaks to them in some way, and I am refusing to blacklist or abandon anyone simply because they disagree with me on this important issue. I don't know if anyone's blacklisted or abandoned me because of my views, but I don't think anybody has.
Well,
but, you know, I think it's emotions run high, but I think it's important to have a level of civility, even if everyone doesn't come up to that standard.
I agree with that, and I think, you know, again, look, you're responsible for your own actions, right? You're not responsible for anybody else's. So you live and you know,
unless you're on a college campus,
right? In which case, you are responsible not just for other people's actions, but their feelings and their opinions. So in the 45 seconds or so that we have left, I've got to ask you your take on the chalking is now violence, apparently, Kurt.
Yes, I have noticed that. It's an act of violence. As someone who's actually been in the military, and served with guys who've been really hurt, I think there are a lot of guys out there who would have been happy if the enemy was merely trying to chalk at them.
Kurt Schlichter. Go buy his book, Conservative Insurgency. Read all of his columns wherever they appear. And if you ever need a good attorney out in L.A., call Kurt. He can maybe make a recommendation, right?
Exactly.
All right, brother. Thank you for coming on the program. It is always a pleasure. Look forward to doing this again soon.
Look forward to talking to you, man.
Kurt Schlichter with us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. The music means we are out of time, unfortunately. Coming up on tomorrow's program, John Cardillo, former New York police officer, host of the John Cardillo Show, talking about the increased violence in Chicago, as well as some problems in New York City. Tony Katz, Ed Morrissey, and all of the day's top Second Amendment news and information coming up on the next NRA News, Cam and Company.